Welcome to the Carpcast, introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and are pretty opinionated. Here's your host, it's Mark and Jamie.
Hello, and welcome to 83 of the Carpcast, episode 83 even. How are we today, Mark?
Oh, we're feeling good. So even though I've got my headphones on, I can hear the fireworks booming around in the neighbourhood.
Yes, atmospheric fireworks. I've fished a lot on firework night over the years. Have you?
I've occasionally, yeah. I remember one night on, it wasn't bonfire night, but... You know, this is back around 2000, we fished Apex or Icom. It was a wedding or something going off, and there must have been thousands of pounds going up, and we saw it all for free. It was great. Caught nothing as well, maybe a bream.
Yeah, I remember fishing one of the Albert Waters when I was a kid, Dove Mere and Sam Mere, many, many years ago, on Bonfires Night. I can remember it quite vividly. We did catch... just trying to think some other places I've fished on bonfire. And that I fished the infamous Manchester Park Lake, and there's one of the locals down there. He has access to those, like the industrial fireworks for shows and stuff. And then he always, ones that would cost thousands and thousands a box. And he was notorious for letting them off. So much so, I think the police used to come. I think the bonfire parties down there were quite legendary a few times. Shout out to Jay if I remember rightly.
That sounds fun, that.
Yeah, I've been on the far bank before now on fire at night over there at the weekend as well, and I was glad I was on the far bank, to be totally honest.
You have your hard hat on.
Yes, yeah. I never know with these bangs in the background of you, if it's fireworks going off near you, if it's you kicking the mic or you farting. I'm never quite sure.
No, well, I'm not kicking the table. I've got my nice thick fluffy socks on, so if I do, it'll be muffled. My brew is on the floor, so I'm not putting that on the table. I cannot guarantee I won't fart mid-podcast. It has happened before. So, yeah, well, most of them will be fireworks.
So, what have we got in store here? I suppose we should have a look around on the net. Now, you may have noticed a couple of weeks ago we had a new on the net jingle. That is because we were already taking most of our news from the excellent carpfeed.com. And I actually had a quick chat with the main man, Tom Ayres, just to see... exactly how they go about it, because he seems to be the person that's behind all this excellent content. So before we do some news, then let's get him to tell us about how we get the news.
It's on the net in association with carpfeed.com.
So I'd like to welcome the man behind all the great content on Carpfeed, Mr. Tom Ayres. How are you doing, pal?
Hi there, I'm very good.
Good. I first spotted your stuff a few weeks ago. We got loads of our material from there. I do notice when really good digital content comes up, it sort of grabs me, because you see a lot of clickbaity stories and stuff knocking around. But you always seem to back it up with the background, with the info. It sounds like you're a busy man.
It does keep me busy, definitely. I've worked here now for 5 years or so on Angling Times, which is one of our sister publications, and sort of felt probably about this time last year, so back end of 2016, that we needed a proper digital kind of proposition, something that reaches those carp anglers that, sadly don't have a habit of buying printed products, and, a new generation that gets a lot of their news from their iPad and whatever while they're in the bivvy. And, we just had this plan to sort of make it as comprehensive as possible. And, that's been one of the big things, is that, everyone can sort of recycle news and flag up a catch report, but sort of digging a bit deeper and getting some of the background to certain things is where you're really giving your readers some value. So that was always sort of at the uppermost of our thoughts, and hopefully we're fairly young and we're sort of learning all the time, but we're hopefully sort of producing some good content.
Have you found a lot of support from Bauer Media, from whoever's sort of direct bosses are, in terms of, have you got a free rein to go for it digitally? Because one of the things I've noticed is the fishing industry is quite a cottage industry. You know, it's quite often the social media job was given to the T-boy. It's like, oh, you can do it. And, you know, there's social media degrees now, and it's a very skilled job. And as you probably know, it's extremely time consuming. So do you think the company you work for, I know you're not obviously not going to say anything negative about the company, but do you feel like really supported when it comes to, like, you know, trying to get up to maybe the speed of other industries when it comes to digital content?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a couple of things there that I'd completely agree with you. Yeah, I mean, we've spoken before, and I think we both agreed that fishing is a sort of naive industry, a cottage industry, as you say, where, you know, you look at other hobby titles or hobby areas, and fishing lags way behind in some of the content delivery and things like that. But I think it's catching up. I think certainly a lot of the tackle companies are realising the value of a presence online, and not just a sort of presence where they're pushing everything towards their readers, their consumers. They're interacting genuinely with the people that they're trying to sell products to. And yeah, with regards to my brief here, I've been very lucky. You know, and as I'm sure you know, and as I'm sure listeners know, fishing isn't awash with money. So to take a punt on something, as we've done with Cartfeed, which, you know, is free at the point of contact for readers, takes a bit of a gamble. And yeah, I've been backed all the way by the people above me, and on a day-to-day basis, I'm left to my own devices, really. And yeah, as you mentioned earlier, it is time-consuming, and generally, I'm a sort of one-man band with all the content that goes up and all the social media platforms that we promote it on. So that does take time. But I was thinking just this week how enjoyable it is, genuinely, and I'm not just saying that to you know, boost the egos of the people that pay my money. It's so enjoyable, because you're talking to carp anglers from all different aspects of the sport. You're interacting with lake owners, with product developers, with big brands, people in this country, people abroad. I'm very fortunate to see and to hear from carp anglers just loving what they do, and that's sort of infectious, and it does rub off on you. I mean, touch wood, it hasn't put me off carp fishing. I know some people that buy lakes end up never fishing again because it just consumes them and it sort of ruins the hobby for them. But for me, it's sort of been the opposite. And yeah, so far it's been, you know, a bit of a ride, a bit, you know, some things have gone better than others. That's part of the thing about being online. You can take a gamble and you can find out almost instantly through sort of analytics whether it was worth it or not, and if it wasn't, you can tweak things or shelve them, and if they do work, then the feedback you get is great. So yeah, it's a new way of doing things, and we're enjoying it, really enjoying it at the moment.
I think you're doing it really well, and one of the reasons for me contacting you, that the news stories are good, and it's eye-catching. You know, there's very few people out there. As I said, it's getting better, and you must have noticed that, but certainly, you know, there's only a few companies doing it really well, I think, the sort of digital content. And is there a printed version of Cartfeed?
Yeah, there is. So we haven't abandoned that at all. We've got a monthly printed version of Cartfeed that goes with Angling Times once a month, the first Tuesday of every month. It's also distributed quite widely free to some tackle shops and to some big fisheries like Linear Fisheries. I know that quite a few copies go down to Linear and get snapped up by others there. So it's all, that was sort of our thinking all along, is to give stuff to the readers for free, because that's what a modern audience is used to these days, whether that's print or online. The two are slightly separate. I have input into the print magazine, but we have a separate editor, my colleague Steve Stones, who was editor of Improve Your Course Fishing. He deals with the day-to-day running of the print side of things, while I'm focused more on the online thing, and we complement each other, but we have different sort of different articles. Some cross over, some don't. So we haven't abandoned print, and obviously print is still, for many of your listeners and for many of our readers, it's still a big part of their sort of routines. But yeah, we're trying to reach that digital savvy audience, that perhaps younger audience that as I mentioned before, just doesn't have that habit that perhaps me and you had as youngsters of buying Carp World or Carp Talk religiously every week. And so, yeah, that's the sort of market that we're looking to branch out into, really, and giving them things that they want, like regular news, but then also some more lighthearted pieces and features and things like that. So it keeps me busy, but we're enjoying it at the moment.
Well, you're doing a fantastic job. I'm glad that we've got a partnership together. It makes my job easier in the podcasting world of gaining news, because I just come to you now, so it's fantastic.
good stuff.
Well, I'm sure we'll get out fishing sometime, do a feature, or maybe you'll get over to Slovenia next year. I look forward to working with you as time goes by.
So do we. That sounds like a good partnership going forward.
For all the news, check out carpfeed.com.
Yeah, so big thanks to Tom and full support to them down at Biomedia, doing what they're doing. It's some of the best content I've seen in a long time. And some of that content, we'll have to go back a week or so now, because it's been nearly 2 weeks since we've done a show, Mark, or an original show, and not one of the selects. But Captain Jack, did you see that?
How could you miss it? It was his great big, was it 68 pound something? You know, it was a few on top of the record of the parrot, and it was every Facebook post for about 2 or 3 days with mixed reactions. I'm sure you saw those as well.
Yes, very mixed reactions. I mean, the biggest thing is Captain Jack has been caught at a British record weight. Now, we know a chap called Bill caught it from the lake over British record weight and was not interested in claiming it. This guy has categorically stated that he will be claiming it. Fair enough. Obviously, the purists have come out and, as usual, belittling it, saying that's the end of the record, blah, blah, blah. And I actually think it should be the end of the record. The not the lines of what's proper and not proper. I believe it. Just that the strains, you know, where there's so many big growing strains from around the world now, it's perfectly legal to legally import them into Britain. You can grow them in this country artificially and stock them into commercial lakes. The flyers are always going to keep growing, as I believe Captain Jack was. The thing with home fen is the fish was stocked. Most of them were stocked small, and then there was a handful of fish, maybe a small percentage of the stock, maybe like, in fact, we can probably find out exactly, because as usual, Carp Feed have all the information. But a percentage of the stock, 15-20%, was put in as bigger fish, obviously, so they could open, as most fisheries do. You know, you put some long-term growers in, you put some middle fish, and then you put a few to fish for straight away. And I know the biggest fish that was stocked in there was 39 pounds. I'm not 100% sure if the 39-pounder is Captain Jack. It most likely is, I would have thought. But that fish is not far off doubled in size in the lake. It's certainly grown 40% of its body weight in the lake. So there's no way the record fish committee are going to be able to refuse this. Like, it's going to be the record. I don't see on what grounds they could refuse it. So, but is it the same as, you know, Dick Walker or Chris Yates' records? Well, I don't know what weight they were stocked into Redmire, but they were certainly imports at the time. And they were obviously flyers, because they were way bigger than anything else in the UK at the time. But there'll be people spinning in their reflective graves, bedrooms or cars at the minute, having compared home fen to Redmire. But at the end of the day, you know, they were fish stocked from abroad. Most of the home fen fish were stocked small, most of them, in fact 80% of the stock. And you take a lake like Eric's Willows, which is was stocked with Croatian fish, but they were stocked small, you know, under £10, the majority of them, which is now throwing up 50s and 60s galore. So it's time to do away with the record. I think there's no point going over the same ground again. You know, this should be accepted as a record. And, you know, what's the point in comparing this? Because there is no comparison. You can't start comparing one lake where a fish might grow to 68 pound completely naturally, and another lake where it was stocked at 30, fed every week of its life in perfect conditions and grew to beat the record. You just can't compare it anymore, I don't think. So.
No, I don't think you can. But what is the purpose of the record? Is it to record just the fact that a fish of that size was caught in this country regardless of the situation? Or is it to record the achievement? You know, I'm going to use a comparison of the, the London Marathon record.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has obviously trained probably most of the life, you know, to achieve that and done a lot of hard work. To catch a record carp, to be in with a chance, you've just got to book on. This is going to sound disrespectful to the captain. You know, he's obviously, you know, I want to say well done to him. And he's had a great time and caught a massive fish without going to France to do it. And, is it a record worthy achievement? And the other point I want to make is, whatever your opinion is, it affects absolutely no one apart from the captain and maybe the owners of the lake. Who really cares what the record does or whether it stays or goes? You know, it's
I like your point of, it is exactly a record. It's not a statement of achievement. You know, if you caught the Conningbrook fish on your first ever session on the lake, you know, when the Conningbrook fish was the British record at 65, 66 pound, whatever it was, you waited your time on the waiting list, you got accepted for a ticket, and you fluked it on your first session. You didn't learn the lake, you didn't do anything. I mean, pretty much how Jim Shelley did. If you remember, Jim Shelley caught it on his first ever session, first ever 48-hour session on there. Now, let's forget Jim Shelley. I wish I'd mentioned him now. Right?
Yeah.
It's getting a bit anal, Jamie, right?
But he, you know, let's say it was me. Let's say I waited.
That would be a fluke.
Yeah, waited, got that ticket and fluked it out in the first 2 hours. Now, and it happened to be bigger than the British record and I claimed it. Now, there was no skill for me really in that capture. It just happened to be swimming about in front of the peg that I'd picked. I hadn't worked the lake out, I hadn't learned it, I hadn't done anything, I just fluked it. So to me, you know, it's not a massive achievement. But in the record books, on paper, it's the biggest fish caught in the UK. Now, how the record, that's what the record book is there for. It's not to say, oh, you know, so-and-so deserved it more than me because they'd grafted, they'd, you know, had it feeding on the spot every week for months and had just primed it and was about to catch it, but I came along and fluked it. Like, that, it's, the record is no record of achievement. It's just a record of how big the fish grew in UK. Now, and again, the Conningbrook fish was an import as well. Small, I believe. I heard it went in at 18 pounds. So how's that different to a lot of the 50s and that are in home fen that are also, and a lot of them are Fenland fisheries. A lot of them were born in this country because Fenland fisheries breed them from the Israeli strain. And a lot of them are actually, you know, born and bred, even though they're not native. But what is native? But the point is the record is to record the biggest carp grown in the UK. By the same token, the big rig fish is no different to Captain Jack. If that was big rig, was Rob Hales bought it at £39, which is the same weight Captain Jack supposedly went in home fen. Now, if Captain Jack is recognised as a record at £68.8, then why wasn't big rig recognised at a record of 70? Because it's still grown from £39 to best part of £70 in a UK water. I think the reason why they didn't accept Big Rig was because it had only been in that particular lake a short period of time. It hadn't actually grown in that lake, but it still had grown in the UK and then was then caught. So it's all so blurred and messed up now. Then let's just stop it. Now, I did read a very good argument by somebody on the net the other day about heritage and why it's important to keep a heritage. Now that heritage could have been, you know, if Donald Leamy stocked Israeli's carp in 1938 or whatever year he started stocking lakes in the UK, then Israeli carp would be our heritage as opposed to the Dutch Leamy strain, I guess. But there would still be a heritage to protect. So I don't know. I think heritage is important in all things. We should respect where we came from. But at the end of the day, you know, evolution is an extremely big factor in the UK as well. And things move on, things change, usually for the better. Not always, not exclusively. But the fact is, we are in this situation now.
Do you know, I think we are in a situation now where a lot of people are absolutely obsessed with that number. You know, I see it in the tackle shop. People, oh, I need to catch some, you know, 20, or I need to catch the, where can I go for a 40? You know, it's kind of, it's pleasing me to say, and you as well, because we've actually been around and caught some of these fish of these numbers. But I couldn't care less now. I like a big fish, we all do. That's why we fish for carp. But you know, I couldn't care less if it creeps over that number or just under. I'm nice, pretty scaly fish. Maybe we should change the record and do it as a measurement of length instead of weight. Then all your fish breeders would be breeding long barbel-shaped carp that fight like stink.
Or yeah,
the carp with the most amount of scales on.
Or them four-foot carp would always win. You know, them four-footers that are knocking around everywhere.
Yeah, big, long, pointy-tailed commons. Well, the record would be, don't know, a good contender would be that common that we was in the Copse Lake at Nashies. How long is that thing?
Yeah, it's pretty long. I know the Wazing fish, the former British record that died. No, that was
a lemon.
3.5 foot, though, that was. I think, oh, was it 3 3/4 foot? I think Bernard Loftus measured it one day, didn't he?
Yeah, that's it. We should start the carp cast length record.
Yeah, well, most other species it's measured in length, because at the end of the day, yeah, a fish getting fat is usually not a good thing. It's you know, a sign that it's greedy or, you know, obese.
Yeah, when we're on the scout for a woman, you know, we don't look for the look for the gut bucket mug. We
you do about 2:30 a.m.
when there's nothing else left.
Carry on, sorry. Yeah, I don't know. As I said, if I'd have turned up on Conningbrook and caught that fish, you know, on the first day, it wasn't a measure of my skillful angling or that I'd hunted it down over a period of time. It was just good fortune. And, you know, quite a lot of times the good fortune is being able to get a ticket for these lakes. You know, that's the first hurdle to overcome, catching a British record. I mean, now if this fish is accepted, which I'm quite confident it will be, if this fish is accepted, then you will be able to fish for a British record, me or you or anybody, for 40 quid a night. Without,
say 40 quid a night.
Yep, without waiting. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of egotistical carpers out there that will now be trying to get their name in the record book and joining that lake should that fish be accepted. I'm sure they will.
How much does the record mean then when it is just a list of captors of the same fish?
Well, you've had a look down the record list. I mean, you know, there's three fish.
As probably before.
Yeah, three fish probably make up 50% of the entire record list since Dick Walker. You know, I mean, the Conningbrook fish, it was that fish for years. It was just every time somebody happened to catch it, a slightly bigger weight. And as we know, the Conningbrook fish was an import, a Kent Riverboard fish. And it was a freak, that's why it grew.
It was a super
big rig of its day. It was a super freak, yeah. And most of these record fish are about 40% bigger than any other fish in the lake it lives in, including the Conningbrook fish, you know, including Mary. You know, they're all 25-30% bigger than anything else in that same lake. Well, I think we're getting the finale on the fireworks. I hope this is not driving everyone mad, or is it atmospheric? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I think a bit of background noise is always atmospheric. I think, you know, I listened back to my chat with John Llewellyn while we were sat on the bank. You got the occasional rustle of the wind or bird squawking. I think it adds to it.
Anyway, what do you think people will say when they find out what me and you are doing a month doubled up on Home Fair next year? Next
we've
week.
Got an exclusive booking with 8 rods out each.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's time to do away with it, isn't it? I think, you know, that the record will be broke. Whatever the record is set at, somebody will find a way to grow a fish bigger now. you know, there'll be a country that they come from or whatever, they'll be kept in extremely good environment, fed, and it will grow bigger. I mean, this is a fact now, so...
Is a point. I have seen one or two people on Facebook saying, you know, this about big rig as well, that the fish was force fed.
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah. Now, how the hell do you force feed a carp? Because that's got to be an edge. I want to know.
Yeah, I think, you know, you get hold of it. You like hold it like a guitar in one hand under your arm, and then you just keep popping boilies in its mouth. You know, you do it for about, I don't know, 10 hours a day, and then do the same thing the next day. Do that for 4 years, maybe. Of course, I'm joking. You cannot force feed a carp. They will eat in front of them. They probably won't eat if you're fishing for them, because they then get worried about picking bait up. But as we know, the best way to grow a big carp is to give it optimum conditions and don't fish for it. Just feed it so it's not worried about getting caught. It just feeds constantly. But, you know, it's, I know if I eat too much, you know, you lay a big cable the following day and, you know, food passes through fish. They crap while they're eating. You know, anyone's ever had a goldfish, yeah, we'll see it shits constantly, as do fish. They're, you know, they can only digest so much depending on oxygen and everything, so you can't force feed a fish, obviously. The fish is going to eat what it wants, and if you give it optimum conditions with you know, the right amounts of oxygen, the right temperature, water, and enough of a good quality food source, it's going to keep eating. That's the long and short of it. But yeah, time to do away with the record. It's, you know, it's not necessarily a record of achievement, and I think that's where all these people getting upset about it are wrong, because it doesn't mean somebody's a great angler because they catch a British record. It could be just luck. You know, the hardest part is getting on that lake, which is quite often, once a fish has gone big, it's almost impossible. But the fact that we now have a fish bigger than the British record living in a lake, anybody can fish. You know, is it going to attract people just hungry for the fame? Not sure. I'll let you know when we've caught it.
But let's spin this round. Let's say one of the, I don't know, say a fishing, you know, manor down at Oxford shot through and broke the record. You know, they seem to be accepted as pucker fish.
Packer.
And that's like, anybody can fish. Would that be accepted? I'm sure it would.
Of course it would. But it's just not going to happen, because they're never going to, as we, what we know about fish, you know, you put a fish in a heavily pressured lake, they're just never going to be able to eat enough with the competition from other fish. It's just never possible. I mean, you know, this home fen, they were stocked, they were fed for, was it 5 years or something? They were fed with nobody fishing. They've put in an extremely good stock in the first place. I don't know, but anyway, shout out to this guy, Richard Reed. He's been on the trip. He was celebrating turning 50 this year. He landed another 53 pounder as well while he was at it. Caught it from the double beach swim. And yeah, it's an impressive size fish. There's a picture that's gone round everywhere of him putting it back into the water, and he's kind of leaning over as he's letting it go. Blimey, what a machine it is. It's a bloody, bloody good or big size carp. So fair play to him. Yeah, when we're going, that's all I've got to say.
Yeah, would you claim a record if you caught it, or would you just enjoy the experience of catching a fish of those proportions?
I mean, I'd obviously enjoy the experience, but, you know, going somewhere like Home Fen, for me, it's like holiday fishing. Like, you go into, you know, for me, syndicate fishing, serious fishing and pleasure fishing are two completely different things, and I would consider going to Home Fen like pleasure fishing, like going on holiday. Would I consider... you know, if I caught a 60 pounder in France or a 58 pounder in England, which one would be my PB? You know, probably the English 58 pounder. But yeah, it's holiday fishing. Would I claim it? I mean, I'm the wrong person to ask, because I'm somebody that In recent years, you know, I've been more involved in the fishing industry with the podcast, with the Northern Angling Show. You know, I've always been, you know, for the last 15 to 20 years, you know, I've been with Nash as a kind of a consultant stroke field tester stroke whatever. So I'm somebody that would actually probably gain from having my name on the British record list. I'd probably gain something personally, financially, maybe, you know, whether it be image or I don't know. There would probably be an ulterior motive for me to do it work-wise. And I still probably wouldn't do it. I'm not saying I would never fish home fen, but I wouldn't set out, right, I'm going to go and try and catch the British record now because it will further my career or whatever. If there was a holiday trip going, you know, a group of lads, group of mates, who like, we're on going, you know, we booked home fen for 4 days, do you want it in? I'd probably go. And if I was lucky enough to catch that carp, would I claim it? I really don't know. I really don't know. Possibly. Because if the record books still exist in 50 years' time, and your name... Yeah, it's like when Man United play Liverpool in the European Cup final, and Liverpool absolutely battered United all the way through, but it was 0-0 and United won on penalties. In 20 years' time, when they look back on that, they wouldn't go, oh, United were lucky to win that. It just says United's name at the top of the list, you know, or, you know, United have won 5 European Cups. Whatever, the record books are the record books, are there forever, and you don't go down there and go, well, he didn't deserve it, he did, he didn't. It's like, it's what's in black and white. So, would it be a good thing to get your name in the record books? Yes. Would I preferred it to have been Mary in its heyday? Obviously. Would I claim it if I so happen? Don't get me wrong, I'm not going out of my way to go and try and catch this fish. Not at all. And I have no trips planned there, booked there, and I don't know anyone that has got a trip planned there. But if that situation did occur, would I claim the record if I caught it a record weight? If it had already been claimed and that fish had already been the record and I caught it bigger, then I probably would, yeah. What about you in that same scenario?
Yeah, I'd unhook it in the net and slip it back. Yeah, right. I don't know what I'd do, to be honest. I'm not really fussed about the record and what happens to it, but I'm not in that situation. I think you have to make that decision. But it's something to show your grandkids. Look at that, man, the Guinness Book of Records. That's me. I caught a great big fat fish.
This is my point. There's a bigger picture than the actual credibility of it, because, you know, you may or may not be credible. Just because you caught it doesn't mean any fish was a credible capture. You might have fluked it. You might have, I've caught fish that I felt like I've not deserved, and I've not caught fish that I felt like I have deserved. So, you know, it's neither here nor there.
I've caught lots of bream that I felt like I just don't deserve.
Even as she was taking a mickey out of you the other day with your bream.
I fish at a lake occasionally. You can't avoid them because there's lots of them and they're massive. And I get people I've never even met, I don't know them, taking the piss out of me on Facebook on every other post I put up.
I forget what Nashi said the other day, it was last week, and it was like, me and Mark are going here or we fish there or whatever, and he went, I hope he's got plenty of bream.
Is any bream in Nash's lakes?
No.
Good, I'll have to bring some. Drop one in.
Let's move on. We've ranted for quite a long time about this. Have you seen anything else on the net, Mark?
Yeah, did you see the Home International at Brasenose 2?
Oh, I did, yes.
It's on the net in association with carpfeed.com, so it's definitely true.
It was won by Wales.
It was won by Wales, and what also disappointed me was Scotland was second, you know, that big carp fishing nation, Scotland, and the lowly little carp fishing nation known as England that kind of started carp fishing came last.
We invented carp, let's be honest.
We did, yes, and not only did we come last, but probably... If we took a Taken 2 type scenario with I have a very special set of skills. what's he called? What's the film? Taken 2?
Oh, Taken. Yeah, I forgot his name now.
Liam Neeson.
Poor accent you did anyway.
Yes, well, if we had a very special set of skills, you know, the England team probably have the most specialist set of match fishing skills, the likes of Mark Bartlett, you know, Harry Pitchers.
Who's Harry Pitchers?
Harry and Mark Pitchers. Harry, what's his face?
Charrington.
Harry Charrington. If you had to bet your life or your child was abducted and you had to send somebody with the most specialist set of skills to get them back by catching carp, I'd probably pick all of those names that all blanked on Brazenose 2, was it?
It was, yes. Which, as we know, like its neighbour, Brazenose 1, there's a hell of a lot of fish in there. It's like, you know, 10, 20 fish catches are commonplace. That's part of the attraction of going down there.
So yes. What happened? Well, the Jocks caught more than the English and the Welsh won. That's what's happened. And some of the best match anglers in the world all blanked. As in zero. There were, what, five or six of them blanked?
Yeah, I've seen the results. I can't remember exactly, but even the winners, you know, there wasn't hauling. So was it just poor conditions, or as like I was saying about off air before we started, the autumn feed up that we all used to rub our hands together and fill our freezers full of bait for just doesn't seem to happen anymore.
Yeah, well, that's another subject. The autumn feed up. I've said for a few years that the autumn feed-up seems to be a thing of the past. Does it ever really happen? I remember, you know, I'd start fishing after these kids went back to school, September, first week in September, I'd start fishing again for my autumn campaign after having a break through the summer. And then it was all kind of geared around introducing bait, a lot of boilies over maybe an 8-week period, for when the fish start having it, and you would clean up, you know, in your chosen area that you were baiting or whatever, and you'd kind of clean up when the fish wanted to really feed heavy. They were, your bait had become part of the sort of natural food, and I don't know if that happens anymore. What do you think?
No, it does in one or two places. You know, there is the odd example, but you know, I've got a theory.
Go on.
Because obviously, as the carp is a cold-blooded creature, as the water cools, so does the fish. Its whole system doesn't work as effectively in the cold. It swims along in September. It gets a belly full of cheap crap bait, or high oil bait. It takes longer to digest, and it's still in the gutter. It eats some more into the cold weather. And it takes even longer and longer to digest, and it's not going to eat while it's got a belly full of crap. And then it eat some more in November and thinks, oh, that's it, I'm going to digest this in March when it warms up again. I'm going to sit mid water and look at all the zigs I'm going to ignore until then.
Yeah, I saw a very interesting piece. I should have bookmarked this, actually. I haven't, so I'm going to hash it by remembering from my withered memory, but it was quite an in-depth piece about bait. I wonder if it was one of the Carp Feed articles, actually. It was Carp Feed or Carpology, and it was talking about the oils in bait and the fact that, you know, when the water's colder, the oils dispersing and stuff. That's right, the article was about using fish meals in winter. Did you happen to see that one?
I've not seen that one, no, but I have seen, I've seen several articles in the past like that, and it's very dependent on the actual fish meal and its content for me.
That's exactly. So
I think, to be honest, I think every one of them will work, but some may only work once.
That makes sense. That's exactly what this article was saying, was that quite often, compared to the sort of, remember like these oily boom in the, was it in like the late 80s, early 90s, everybody used to glug the bait in oil and
There was an article, this is going back in Carp World, called The Killing Fields, all about that, when, you know, people were just splashing oil all over the baits, throwing them into Harefield, and, you know, the fish were just getting, well, basically poisoned.
Yeah, well, what this article was saying is that most of the fish meals these days, especially the good quality ones, they have a much lower oil content than any oil we've traditionally used over the years. So they're basically saying it's not all companies' fish meal, but quite often, just because it's a fish meal bay doesn't mean it's high oil content, and it's the oil that's the bad thing in the colder water temperatures. I'm sure it was a CC Moore article, actually. Must have been in Carpology. In fact, I'm pretty sure it was. And it was one of the best articles explaining, you know, because I don't know much about bait, and it was one of the best articles I read. Kind of, obviously, they were pushing their own fish meal bait, but basically saying, I get asked all the time, I mean, people ask me like I'm an expert, but just because we have the podcast, you know, I'm using this bait, do you think I need to change for the winter? And, you know, I usually go with my stock answers, the baits that I know work in the winter, but I've used Scopex squid all year round. You know, when other people have changed and gone on to the like amber, the bird food mixes and stuff, I've stuck with the Scopex squid and caught right through the winter, you know, many years in a row. I've done that and just not changed, and just not felt the need to, thinking, right, well, you know, if the bites slow down, then I will change, but just not needed to. So
yeah, the Scopex squid, it is one of those baits. It's probably in the top five ever. It is one of the very few special ones. But there's also, I know from working the tackle shop, there's the baits that are available. And then obviously look on Facebook as well. How many of these Fred in the Shed bait companies that pop up every 5 minutes that get a recipe offline that, you know, they think, oh, it's not oily enough, I'll splash another 30 million per pound.
Yeah.
Catch through the summer, and then the lake or venue shuts up through the winter where they've been piled in. And they wonder why.
I remember having a conversation with Terry Hearn about this when we were on the Yateley together many years ago, and we were talking about cold water, winter baits and all that stuff. I remember him telling me about his dad's pond. He used to, you know, take a lot of his, you know, watch the signs in his dad's pond, how the carp were acting and stuff, at different times of the year. So like some days, you know, they'd be lay dormant all winter, it'd be really cold, and just one day out of the blue they all look really active for whatever reason, he doesn't really know, but they'd look really active and that'd be a good day to go fishing, because there's obviously a reason why all of a sudden they'd just perked up from being pretty dormant for a little while. Anyway, I remember him telling me about one year it'd been really cold and the fish were extremely dormant, not doing anything, and they seemed to be really active one day. So he fed them with, I forget what he fed them with, but it was particle. It was some sort of particle. He said they wolfed the lot down. The following day, he fed them again. They wolfed it all down. They did this for a few days. And then he put some boilie in the next day. I think he was using dynamite sauce at the time, which I know is a pretty meaty, solid bait, isn't it? It's I don't know what the base mix is and stuff on it. And but anyway, he said when he put the boilies in, they ate all the boilies and then they didn't eat again. That was it. Now, yeah. It's kind of what you're saying. It just filled them up. That was the end of it.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Imagine if you could, if you're underwater or something, like, I don't know, if you were in the position that Kev Nash is with his legs, you could control what bait goes in, not just for the winter, but all year round. And just had, you know, kept away from the fish meals all the time, and just, you know, still have the nutritious baits, but, you know, when it, you know, got, you know, you could drop the proteins as it got into the autumn, as the water temperature was dropping.
And yeah,
you could condition it to fish all the way through.
Do you know what I think needs to happen now? I mean, it's a bit of the magic gone from fishing, just because we already kind of, we know, you know, with the underwater films, Corda started it off with the underwater. Now it's actually quite cheap to make underwater videos yourself. You know, technology, you can put GoPros on the end of a stick and whatever. You can buy the, you know, Chinese equivalent of a GoPro for literally 2 kilos of boilies. And so is it about time we had, you know, like a spring watch or a summer watch or an autumn watch like you get on TV, where somebody actually films 12 months of the year underwater, so we actually really get to see, you know, could somebody rig a lake with cameras all over it? And I mean, you could potentially do it on home fin. All those carp are chipped, aren't they? And I believe you can actually see where they are on the computer screen. So would that be the way to do it?
That have you recasting?
I wonder if that would be the way to do it. Rather, you know, put cameras in certain areas of the lake, maybe where you feed them and stuff, but the rest of the time, just follow the carp on a screen.
Yeah, I think that's maybe taking it to an extreme, but if I ran a data kit, like, I would certainly really control the bay that went in. Because you think of it from an economic point of view, if your lake doesn't fish in the winter, you're not getting any, no one's going to be fishing it. If you can condition the fish, you know, by just feeding them the right stuff all the year round, so they continue feeding and getting caught through the cold, you're going to make more money. And if any fishery owners out there want to pay me for consultancy fees,
I think the Avenue fish are all chipped as well, aren't they? I think you could technically see those on the screen where they are, what they're doing.
Yeah. Here's a question that comes from that on a different tack. With all the underwater technologies and the videos and stuff we can do, why has no one invented the Wonder Rig yet?
The Wonder Rig.
Yeah. Why has it not happened? It's all there. All the ingredients are there. It's just got to be put together.
I don't know how annoying it is for you people listening at home, but it is literally like the Blitz going on in the background. I mean, to be fair, it's November the 5th. It is actually fireworks night, Sunday night, although most of the displays in Blackpool were yesterday. But there's literally thousands of pounds going up in people's back gardens everywhere around me. It's crazy. Who's got that sort of money to... I read five interesting facts on Guy Fawkes today, actually.
Was he a nice chap?
I don't think so. He didn't have a particularly good ending. He was hung, drawn and quartered. You know what the drawn bit is of hung, drawn and quartered?
Yeah, it's pretty much your guts ripped out, ain't it?
Yeah, so your innards pulled out while you're still alive. Yeah, so I'm guessing the hanging bit doesn't come first.
The quartered bit is where you're chopped into four pieces and shipped off to different areas or what have you as a warning to others.
Yeah, I think they stretch you as well, don't they, in the hung, drawn, quartering. But I didn't realise that the bonfire bit of the fireworks display. The fireworks obviously signify the gunpowder and stuff, the barrels and barrels of it that old Mr. Guy Fawkes. But Guy Fawkes was one of the team. I don't know why he kind of got the blame.
He was the scapegoat.
Yeah, he wasn't the leader of the firm. He was just the fireworks expert. He was the gunpowder expert, the bomb maker, as he would be called these days. And it was a plot to assassinate or overthrow King James. As usual, it was to do with religion. It was because it was the Catholics. And they weren't trying to overthrow the government. They were just trying to overthrow King James. And because it was obviously a monarchy then, there was no prime minister or government or anything. It was just the king and the whole monarchy, and they wanted rid of him because it was his daughter who was 4 years old or something, maybe a little bit older, but certainly no older than 10. It was his daughter who's in line, and they reckon they'd have some sympathy for the Catholics, so it was religious based. And the bonfire side of it was invented by King James the following year after the assassination attempt on the anniversary. This is why you burn the guy at the bonfire. They claim that he was burnt, but he wasn't. He was actually hung, drawn and quartered, but it was quite common to burn people at a stake in those days. So yeah, he actually invented the symbolism of the bonfire to actually burn Guy Fawkes. And it all stemmed from there, and we all do it. It goes on all around the world. The Americans do it and everything, and it was all King James, and all about religion, as most wars seem to be, or most significant events in history. But yeah, there was civil unrest even in those days. But I'm guessing the Prime Minister, and the way our country's run now is probably a bit better than it was under a dictatorship and monarchy. I wonder what, I don't know much about history, but I wonder what year it was when they suddenly decided that, do you know what, the monarchy's not and doesn't run the gaff no more. We're going to, you lot, you can just be a symbol of the country. Let's get someone in that knows about business to run the country. Let's get a democracy in. I wonder when that actually happened.
I wish I'd, could it have been a particularly lazy king who just said, I can't be bothered with this, I just want to drink ale and have lots of wives. So you run the country.
Yeah, but they were voted in, weren't they? So it must have been a brave decision 1 year to go, I'll tell you what, when my dad dies, I won't run the country. You lot vote and you decide who runs it. I'll just take the money and pretend I run it and live like a king.
You also, there's a question, and I'm not drunk, by the way, but do you think in some parallel universe where the cart police are in power... They have Guy Carp's knife in effigies of Bigwig and burnt at the stake. I wasn't drinking hot chocolate, it's good stuff.
I'm glad we've carried on. For those of you behind the scene, it's Mark's missus is away, I believe. Is she abroad or something?
Yeah, she's in Sweden, which apparently I sent her a text earlier on asking if it was full of blonde people in saunas, and it's not, so I'm quite disappointed.
It is in certain parts of the city.
We actually have a few listeners in Sweden, don't we? So, no disrespect. Hi, hope you're well.
Yeah, and send us pictures of the blonde women in saunas.
Blonde women in saunas.
Yeah, so we're in a unique position. Mark would normally be fishing now on a Sunday evening, but it's a bit late now, isn't it, for you to get fishing after work on a Sunday and get set up, and your days off are a bit different this week anyway.
I've swapped because one of the lads has got something on, so I'm working tomorrow, Tuesday, Wednesday off, and I will be going fishing. And do you know what I might do, just for a giggle, just to amuse everyone who thinks I catch nothing but bream? I might go hiking and Facebook Live a bream. Just for laughs.
Yeah, so we're in the unusual position of I'm doing nothing on a Sunday evening. The missus is watching Next Factor and other said crap, so I'm kind of banished upstairs. Normally I might be playing a bit of poker online or something, but I haven't done today for whatever reason, been doing stuff all day. Mark's got no misses and hasn't gone fishing, so we're in the unusual position of just having plenty of time to chat about everything.
Crap, basically.
Yeah, so we've been on the phone an hour and 10 minutes. We worked out we'd recorded about 40 minutes. When we started recording, we normally do about an hour, don't we, for our bit. And so the missus was cooking a roast and she said it's going to be about an hour. I said, okay, fine, put it on now because... will be about an hour with Mark. We've done an hour and 10 minutes, but actually only recorded about half hour because we've been chatting shit because we're both in that Sunday night chatting shit mood. And
let's be honest, this is pretty much where the podcast originated. The fact that we have an hour phone call almost every time chatting bollocks. We both listened to podcasts and thought, oh, we can record this.
Yeah, so the missus brought my dinner up after an hour and 10 minutes. I was like, do you know what, Mark, we're getting in the flow of this. We've got to point number 2 on our list of 10 and we've done an hour and 10 minutes. So how about we take a little break, a toilet break, I'll eat the food and we'll carry on. So this could ramble for another couple of hours yet, although it is Louis Theroux at 9. Have you seen this? Have you seen the film, the Scientology film that he made?
I haven't. No, I've heard it was on Joe Rogan, wasn't he, talking about it? I've not actually seen the film. No, I'm going to watch that.
BBC Two, 9 o'clock. So that gives us an hour and 10 minutes to chat shite.
Yeah,
but yeah, I really do want to watch that. I'm saying the missus just went, "Oh, Louis Theroux's on later." I was like, "All right, okay, yeah," because there's obviously hundreds of them. And while I am quite into Louis Theroux, she went, "Oh, it's the film. Oh, it's about Scientology." And I remember, same as you, I listened to him on Joe Rogan when just after he'd made the film, and it sounded extremely interesting. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to watching that. BBC Two, 9 p.m. Obviously you're going to hear this probably Monday or Tuesday, and it'll be too late. there we go, you'll be able to catch up, I would have thought, on BBC iPlayer.
Yeah, or Cody. Is it,
is a little worth a look, actually. I don't know if you've noticed me retweeting a couple of Louis Theroux things, but I do really like Louis Theroux. He's got an extremely dry, piss-taking sense of humour.
I remember I've watched a few of his stuff. I do like him. He should do a podcast. I think he'd be brilliant.
Yeah.
But I remember we watched one with the Westboro Baptist Church.
I saw that one.
It was kind of funny because they just didn't get the fact he was, you know, taking the piss out of them.
That's what he does, but he does it without upsetting people. He's got a unique skill of fronting some nasty people. He's done the rednecks. He's done everybody, hasn't he? He's been into like a... well, he did it with the Westboro Baptist Church, didn't he? Like talking about the, you know, if your daughter married a black man and all sorts of stuff. And then, but he seems to absolutely rip the piss out of them to their face in such a way that they don't want to kill him.
Yeah, I think the only one I've seen him come a cropper is. Do you remember WCW? Championship Wrestling?
No,
it was like the opposite of the WWF. They had like, you know, the Monday Night Wars and blah blah. It was good viewing anyway. Anyway, he was interviewing some of the wrestlers at the WCW training facility, which is called the Power Plant. And he made a comment something like about it's all choreographed, it's all planned, it's fake.
Mm.
Oh, they beat the shit out of him.
Did they? Well, on Twitter, there's a couple of Louis Theroux associated channels that I like.
Yeah.
One's called Louis Theroux Bot, and all day it just posts. So, you know, he has this saying, he always says, I'm off to Connecticut to meet Jody. Jody was involved in the fashion industry and she has received rape threats or whatever it is, like the particular topic of the thing. So there's a Twitter account called Louis Theroux Bot that just makes up, because he always says it in the same phrase. In the same sentence, so it just posts spoof ones. Like I've just got a couple up here now. So the other day, it's a really popular account. It's got like 40,000 followers. It only follows him. That's it. It's one following, which is him, and it's got 40,000 followers. So there's one this morning. I'm in Jerusalem to meet Joseph, a former falconer turned wedding DJ who believes dogs can look up. The one before that was, I'm in Nepal to meet Clara, a former dubstep producer turned white nationalist who believes in the healing powers of crystal. I'm in Lisbon to meet Ren, a former landlord turned bounty hunter who believes there's no such thing as oxygen. It's just that, it just makes them up all day long. They post these things in the style of Louis Theroux. I'm in Rome to meet August, a former baker turned extreme life coach who believes they saw God's face in a tortilla. It's just crap all day long. Anyway, they did one the other day and Louis Theroux retweeted it and said, if it gets so many retweets, I'll actually say it, whatever it was.
Yeah.
So he did it. Let's see if I can play it. I probably can. It wasn't even one of the best ones, I don't think, but...
I'm in Amsterdam to meet Hannah, a former IT expert turned cyber goth who believes Hull is a portal to hell.
Did you get that one? I mean, Hannah.
I did. That's not quite... I think that's quite accurate about Hull.
Believes Hull is a portal to hell. Yeah, so he actually retweeted this one. So there's Louis Theroux Bot, which is certainly worth a look. It gives me hours. You've got to like Louis Theroux, like, to find it funny, I think, because if you've ever watched him, he always says that. I'm in Hull to meet John, the fisherman, who believes boilies are for the devil. And there's another one called No Context Louis, which is another quite funny account. Again, you have to like Louis Theroux, but No Context Louis, it just quotes things that he says, but completely out of the context of whatever he said it in, which again is absolutely hilarious. Because I don't know if you saw the one last week where he's in, it's all about guns and gun crime, and he's in whatever the gun capital where the most murders are in America, he's in there, and he's interviewing one like gangland guy. And, he's like, this is whatever his name was, like, this is, I'm here to meet Josh. He's got four babies to four baby mamas. And it's like, and somebody posted on Twitter immediately is, did Louis Theroux just say baby mamas? Anyway, one of the no context Louis tweets was, just a picture of Louis Theroux's face. Then it has the quote underneath, and it's got, he's got four babies to four baby mamas. It's when you take it out of context, it's just funny as hell. There's some of the stuff he says. So yeah, no context. Louis is also an extremely
worth a look.
Another one. She said there was no dick too big. He had four kids by four baby mamas, and there ain't no gunshots. We can chill. It's just like pictures of him and quotes completely out of context. Pretty funny, but again, you have to like Louis Theroux. I'm sure there's some people out there that hate him, but I just love his sense of humour. I think it's because he's just so serious with it. He keeps a straight face, doesn't he? It's
good. Yeah, he's really good at what he does. I don't watch him or follow him as much, but you know, whenever he's on, I'm flicking through. I'm like, well, I like him. I'll just see what he's on about. And there's one or two when they have caught him. He's very entertaining.
Yeah, it's good. I tell you what, we've been chatting for a little while, so let's pay some bills. We mentioned Rob Hales earlier, the infamous RH Fisheries. If you heard Kevin Nash last week, Kevin had some things to say about Rob, and basically said, I can't believe he gets the flack that he does because he's making big fish available to the masses. Like it or lump it, he has some absolutely fantastic fisheries. One of which, Mark, we're going to be fishing on, aren't we?
Stitch.
Yes, Stitches is what you get when you misspell his name. What Louis Theroux gets from his baby mamas. But now, there's five stunning carp fisheries at RH Fisheries. Some of them are syndicates, some of them are day tickets. A couple of the syndicates you can actually book holiday swims on. And a couple of the syndicates, there are open access trips in the spring. Now, a lot of Rob's fisheries are closed for the old close season, and some of them they now open up for the in the springtime, arguably one of the best times of year. The Sitch does that, and the famous Acton Burnell complex does that as well, as does Western Park, which has got some fantastic scalies, and you can also stay in the boathouse on Western Park. So probably one of Rob's earliest fisheries, the Monument 1 and 2 now, is a day ticket fishery, operates on 36-hour sessions, which gives the fish a rest. They get a night off every 2 days because of how he does the booking system. rhfisheries.com is the website, 01952463141. You can ring up and book the Monument. The Sitch, we are operating a Carpcast social on in April, which I'll tell you about in just a minute, because the places are starting to sell out now. But Mark and I are going to be there. Rich from Fired Up Barbecue is going to be there. We're going to have two. We're splitting the week into two, basically. You can fish the whole week if you want, or you can fish it in two halves. We will have a social, piss up and a barbecue on each half of the week. So it doesn't really matter if you book the first half or if you book the second half. You will certainly have a few beers with us. It's in stunning scenery in Shropshire. Very close to the Midlands, not too far from Birmingham. Very accessible by the whole country. Mark and I will be there for the week. Rich Fired Up Barbecues will be there for the week. Or by contacting RH Fisheries, you can book the holiday swim on there pretty much any week of the year. Apart from our week when we're on there, because Mark and I may well be in that swim. You've also got the Avenue, which is syndicate only. You got to get to know Rob, as it's in the grounds of his house, the Avenue. The stock in there is ridiculous, 60s, 50s, 40s, loads of them. The growth rates are incredible. It's got the Little Avenue as well, which is an open access lake. You can just put, it's a really intimate, private little lake. There's a big viewing platform at one end, scaffolding that you can climb up, feed the fish, watch the fish. It's extremely intimate. You can book the lake privately for you and two of your mates. Acton Burnell is open access in the spring, and you can apply to join the syndicate on there. You've got the Top and Bottom Lake. Top and Bottom Lake used to have two of the biggest carp in the UK in there. I think there's maybe one still in there in the Bottom Lake. The Top Lake's got about 25-50s. Western Park as well needs no introduction. As many the Carp Talk people regularly fish that. Bev Clifford, Crowey, they've written about that place a lot. It's absolutely stunning. You can book the boathouse. and catch some of these scaly fish on there. All the lakes are in Shropshire. They're all beautiful. The Sitch, which we are running our event on, is right in the middle of a forest, in the middle of nowhere. Make as much noise as you want. We could have a festival on there if we wanted, Mark, which we're probably not going to, but we could
say... Like a bloodstock or a download.
Yes, something like that, with some thrash music. But yeah, if, and also Rob sells carp. He breeds carp. He's got some of the best facilities I've ever seen. I've been up there to have a look at it all. It's grew the infamous big rig up there, and he has, you know, many English born fish that he breeds himself. They are absolutely stunning. I've actually seen two stockings this week that Rob has done. He's had some fish delivered up at Clearwater Fisheries. I saw those going in. They're all C2s. They're absolutely amazing looking fish in fantastic condition. And Kevin Nash had a few of his fish delivered as well for a new lake that he's got that he's dug and he's growing the fish on. And I saw them both absolutely amazing fish. If you want to get an order in for the Super Freaks or whatever, then again you can contact rhfisheries.com. I know they're running a year or two in advance on the fish orders, but love him or hate him, the guy certainly knows what he's doing with breeding fish. And he's got, so you know, as Nashy said on last week's show, week before's, he said Rob certainly isn't making money. He knows what it costs to run the lakes, to develop the lakes, to develop the fish breeding program as he's doing, and it's a hell of a lot of investment, you know, and he's doing it to see how good he can grow fish. So you can check out the videos on the Facebook, on the rhfisheries.com website, and you can see how nice the fish are for yourself. What's the news flash?
Oh, the phone bigging up. Oh, it's gone off the screen now. Do you know, I've just gone on Twitter, just followed Louis Theroux.
Yeah,
and next tweet underneath it is by a band called Cattle Decapitation. Can we bring them to the festival?
Maybe. Are we having a festival?
Some lovely ballads.
Are we having a festival at the Sitch now?
I think we should. Oh, they want the tweet underneath that finishes with "Simply Lovely." So you know what that is.
We certainly do. Yeah. If you would like to join Mark and myself on the Sitch, we are there from the 14th of April next year until the 21st of April. It's probably going to be the only Carpcast social we're doing of the spring. I don't even think we did one this year, did we, Mark? 2017?
No, it was sorely missed.
Yeah, we had one planned, and unfortunately it fell through. Some sailing club couldn't be bothered replying. But apart from that, yes, 14th to the 21st of April, which is a Saturday to Saturday. You can fish for the entire week if you want on a fantastic lake. It's stuffed full of fish, the Sitch. They're all cracking looking fish. There are a number of videos on YouTube if you want to find out more about the Sitch. I've actually been watching Carl and Alex made one on there when Alex was very young, and it was about 4 or 5 years ago, and they did it with Paul Garner, or Dr. Paul Garner. And Paul showed an extremely interesting rig for fishing the sort of soft silt and stuff. And please, nobody watch it who's going to fish, because I'm going to be using it and I want to catch all the fish. But it is very heavily stocked, carp to £45. They're growing really well in there, and it's a stunning lake right in the middle of a forest. You know, you've kind of got to go through bushes, even just to get to the next swim, you got to go through trees and bushes, and it's a stunning lake. And we'll be down there. As I said, Rich is going to be doing the barbecue for us. Barbecue's £10 a head. You can fish. We're splitting the week in two. Fish the whole 7 days, Saturday to Saturday, if you so wish. Or you can fish Saturday to Tuesday, like three nights. And we'll have a social on the Sunday night, so that if anybody fishing Saturday to Tuesday, we'll get the barbecue and social. Or you can, we have a changeover day on the Tuesday, and you can fish Tuesday till the following Saturday, which is four nights. Tuesday night, Wednesday, Thursday night, Friday night. Yeah, four nights. And again, we will have another barbecue and social probably on the Friday, Thursday or Friday. It'd be the Thursday, I reckon, so that if anybody's got hangovers, we don't have to get up the following morning and pack up. You can actually have a day in bed if you want. So yeah, we'll probably have the social on the Thursday night. And obviously, if you stay the whole week, you can have a couple of socials. firedupbarbecues.com if you are interested in booking Rich for your own private do, and I can highly recommend it. Anyone who's been on one of our socials before will be testament to the fact that Rich's food is amazing, well cooked, and yeah, they're a couple of good lads. I'm looking forward to having them down there for the week. Rich is going to fish for the whole week. Yeah, and it looks like a thoroughly good do, Mark. I'm really looking forward to that, actually, and it'll be just before I move away to Slovenia, so it'll be a great chance to catch up, hopefully catch a few fish. Rob Hales is pretty convinced that everybody will catch. It's a very well stocked lake, and especially in that springtime, in the prime time, most people will catch fish, and hopefully somebody will have a good 40. But I know there's got a big head of 30s in there.
Is there any bream in there?
It's a very good point. I can find out. I am not sure.
Because if there's one, I know whose net it'll be in.
Probably mine, if you catch it in the middle of the night and you just switch it over quick. Ooh, look what's on the end of your rod.
Yeah, it's a bit of revenge after you was, whenever you were leaving before me on the wool pack in the Ives days. There was always an extra rubbish bag appeared in my swimmer under my back of my car.
Well, 14th to the 21st of April, and being carp anglers and moon biased, it is a new moon week. The new moon is on Monday the 16th, so 3 days into the Saturday, Sunday, Monday, yeah, 3 days into the session is the new moon. So that's not an accident, I can assure you. When I was given the dates, I would always pick one around a moon phase. So yeah, it'd be great. I know there's a lot of people inquired about the hire or about a Carpcast social, so yeah, please come and join us. It would be great. And obviously you can always come and join me in Slovenia next year. It's the diary's filling up fairly fast. I'm getting an inquiry literally every day for the Slovenia and Croatia trips. You're going to hear a lot about Slovenia and Croatia over the next year or two. It's the place is blowing up as the place to go fishing. The climate's stunning, the fish are big, the fish are also getting bigger. It's not quite peaked over there. You know, a lot of the French lakes, the fish haven't really got bigger in the last 10 years, have they? You know, it's kind of hit its peak and passed it a little bit. Croatia and Slovenia, they're nowhere near at the peak yet. And the stocks are incredible. Some of the stocks have got, you know, 150, 50 pounders plus up to, you know, just shy of 80 pounds. Dave Levy, shout out to Dave. We will be getting Dave back on very soon. He had an 88 pounder from Shumba a week before last, which we've already spoke about. Fish that was actually believed to be gone. But there's a lot more to Croatia and Slovenia than that Shumba, which is the one that people know about. We've got four lakes over there. It's fairly easy access. There's a couple of budget airlines, EasyJet fly from Stansted, Wizz Air fly from Luton. The prices are not expensive. The country's cheap when you get over there. Check out vipcarpholidays.com. But as I said, we're getting an inquiry every day at the minute. The phone rings or I get an email, and it is filling up quick. We can take quite a lot of people on any given week, maybe eight maximum on any given week, but you know, we're taking bookings for fours, sixes. In fact, Alex from Clearwater actually booked a trip in middle of May today, funnily enough, for six of them. In fact, yep, May is nearly half gone for next year. As usual with any other lake, spring and autumn are the best. November is a particularly good month over there. You catch a few less, but the fish are really big. Does seem to be the big ones, but the lake's being very deep, and the summer being very hot, so 30 degrees most of the summer, so the October and November are particularly good months. But it's also a fantastic place to visit with your partner for the summer. Do a few days on Bled, do a few days on another lake, and maybe go and explore some of the coastline in Croatia, which a couple of the people have booked trips. That's what they're doing. They're bringing the missus, they're coming fishing for a little bit, then they're hiring a vehicle and going exploring some of the islands off the coast of Croatia, because the Croatian coast is amazing. There's just little islands. Some of them are actual natural parks, national parks, you know, islands like off the coastline between Croatia and Italy. And it's just.
And they filmed with some of Game of Thrones out there.
Yes, they did. There's festivals over there. You can tie it in with the trip to a festival, a Hideout Festival, or one of the festivals down at Tisno in Croatia. It's my favourite part of the world. I don't say that lightly. You know, I've been to a lot of places over the years, especially around Europe, and never have I seen somewhere that I'd probably want to go, even if there was no fish. But the fact that the fishing is stunning, amazing, the fish are growing, everyone's so friendly, everyone speaks English, it's quite cheap. It's just a no-brainer, really. It's an absolute no-brainer. So yeah, vipcarpholidays.com, you can book, it's all set up there. You can have a look on the website. There's a gallery with all the big fish. We've got a fantastic European angler, Gasper, who speaks the language, obviously, English well, and can deal with everything we need over there. And I've set it up exactly how I'd want to fish. You can fly, you'll be picked up from the airport, and it'll be like a home from home, the equipment that you need, or that you'll be supplied with. You know, I've had a lot of people that said, oh, is it a two-man bivvy? Do I have to share with my mate snores, blah, 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 blah. You're fishing as in the same comfort that you would be at home. You know, we're having indulgence bed chairs, you'll have your own bivvies. Your own cooking gear, your own cool box. There'll be ice runs done in the week to keep your stuff cold. You'll be able to hire fridges if you want. If you're in the colder months, you'll be able to hire gas heaters, all sorts of stuff. The equipment is exactly as I would want it to be if I go fishing without my own kit. I don't want anybody thinking, I don't feel comfortable fishing without my own rods or whatever. So yes, vipcarpholidays.com, check it out.
Oh, what about a worth a look?
Worth a look.
I've not watched it myself, but I see everyone's sharing the new Nash social.
Ah, yes, I did watch it. Actually, I watched it the first night it came out. Obviously, it's filmed on R1, R2 and R3, the lakes owned by the Carp Centre in Shropshire. Shout out to Harry and his good lady wife over there. We actually interviewed his son David as well while we were over there. Someone won the earlier Carpcast from the summer, and what a fantastic set of lakes. So yeah, I watched it the day it was released. I think Nash set the bar on these types of videos, to be completely honest. It's certainly worth a look. It showed the camaraderie between all the staff. They caught some fantastic fish. The film editing, I mean, Carl and Alex do most of the editing. Everyone knows how good their stuff is these days. You obviously had Carl and Alex and Ollie Davis filming, as well as a couple of the other guys as well. They all had GoPros and stuff, and there's a couple of little themes and stories running through it. You had the Les Cam, everybody remembers, the estate manager, shout out to Les off the last year's social on Teleats. It's a thoroughly good watch. You can see all the new products in there, but they don't mention any of the products. There's no hard sell or, you know, check out this new bit of fish equipment or whatever. There's none of that. It's just in the shots. And it's just entertaining, I would say. You know, it's a good hours fishy watch. It's fantastic. And Alan fished R2 that I fished. He struggled. He ended up having some whackers. I won't spoil it for you, but he did struggle. So it's nice to see it, you know, an angler of his caliber having to work it out. And you know, technology had a pretty important effect on him catching in the end. But yeah, go and watch it. It's really, really good. It's certainly worth a look.
Yeah, I'll just give another quick worth a look before we get off this. You know how occasionally when things have been running for quite a while, they can go a bit stale?
Yep.
Well, I've got to give a shout out to Harry and Mark doing Fox's Challenge, because I think the last one is one of the best yet.
I've not seen that one yet, but I do enjoy Harry Pictures.
Yeah, Harry Pictures. I can't remember where they fished, but Mark asked to fish cat-handed.
Okay.
To swap all his reels on and cast left-handed, and it's quite amusing. Go to YouTube and the Fox channel, find it and give it a watch. You'll not be disappointed. I enjoyed it.
Fantastic. I've got written down on my notes here, crazy cat lady. I can't remember how much. how much we said about this on the last episode, because I've spoke about this story with so many people recently. Yeah. You know, people who are interested. Kevin was interested. I can't remember if we spoke about it on the last podcast. Yeah. I think we did, actually. But yeah.
On the last podcast, you left it off where your wandering cat had reappeared after 6 months and came in your house, ate your food, slept on Megan's bed, crapped on the floor, and then went out again.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I did discuss it with Kevin, I think, while you were on holiday. But yeah, it turns out we put a new... It did come back after a couple of days. We put a collar on him with a note in a little message in a bottle type job on its collar, basically saying that please ring us about this cat, and Rachel put a phone number on it. The phone rang, and this crazy cat lady that actually lives about 50 metres behind our house on the next road, she definitely had a poster through the door when Rachel printed up these posters when our cat went missing and posted it through every one of the neighbours' doors. This woman definitely had a poster. So she's rung her up. She went, "Oh, my Frankie, what are we going to do about my Frankie?" Because our cat is now called Frankie by this woman. Although it's called Puss Cat by us. But so, yeah, Rachel went round to see her. She had about 20 cats in there. I think what it is, she puts food outside for the cats to like lure them in, then just locks them in for 6 months to make sure they stay with her. Because she was a bit gutted, like when it turned out that cat was no longer hers, it was ours. She was like, "Oh, what am I going to do about my Frankie?" I think Rachel went, "It's not your Frankie, it's our Puss Cat." But as it turns out, we're going to move abroad next year. Or certainly live abroad for 6 or 7 months. It'd be quite handy. This woman can keep him. It's one thing taking a dog abroad with you, but I'm not sure about a cat. So, especially when they're selfish, they can just wander off again. So, yeah, it now has two homes. Although it has been with us quite a bit. If it gets shouted out or whatever, it creps on the carpet and gets told off, it's like punishes us. It goes to the enemy for a day or two. And then just saunters back in like nothing happened. But yeah, I think it was catnapped, to be totally truthful.
Oh, that was a poor joke.
That wasn't a joke. It was... Why was
catnapped.
It? Catnapped, yeah. just something else I've seen on the net today, actually, is... a guy we both know very well, Gordy Howes. He posted a picture up of one of the kippers from Shella Lagoon. It's on the St. Ives complex that he runs, and their former home to one rotund woman that we were both fortunate enough to catch. Otters, have you seen this?
I have seen it, yeah. It's a fish called the Sheffield Linear. It's not one I caught while I was playing on the shallow, but one I've certainly seen in the water on a couple of occasions. And, a sad sight as any otter fish. And it's not the only otter fish that's popped up on my news feed lately. And it's only the beginning of November. You know, 4 months of cold where carp are the most vulnerable. So if you've got a fishery out there and it's not fenced, it's never too late. Get something in place if possible. Boom, 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 boom.
I'm just sat here thinking, pop, what can we do about this? We'll just take a quick break until the Blitz finishes.
The Carpcast, in association with the Northern Angling Show, the North's biggest fishing event at Event City Manchester, 24th and 25th of February. For early entry and the cheapest tickets, visit northernanglingshow.co.uk.
You've fished the shallow. Is it fenceable?
Unfortunately not.
No?
No, it is... It is basically one great big complex of lakes. You know, they just like back onto each other, and you know, it's probably over 300 acres in size over that side of the road, with the you know, the shallow, long reach meadows, you know, the stake pits, the fjords, and I dread to think what it would cost. It'd be into the hundreds of thousands of pounds to do anything about it. And that's if you ever could. You've got the sailing club on there as well. The skiers up on the long reach.
Yeah, I read a few of the comments underneath Gordy's post, and a few people have shared it, and it seems like some carp anglers are a bit apathetic, just saying, oh well, you know the risks, you know, fence it or lose it type thing. And I'm starting to see a little bit of that, even carp anglers being a little bit sort of blasé, well, it's your own fault, it's your fishery, you make money, but it's just not practical on some places, is it? Especially a lot of lakes that back onto rivers and stuff, and there are some places where it's either not feasible or not practical. I mean,
yeah. Anyone who's knocking Gordy and his fishery management has never met the chap who, you know, used to work for the EA, and you know what he's forgotten more about fishery management than either of us two will ever know.
Yeah, I completely agree. And sometimes it's just not practical. Now, I know Gordon, you know, he doesn't make loads of money out of that complex. I mean, he did a fisheries, you know, he lost the fat lady, which was probably accounted for the bulk of his income, to cover the cost of running those lakes, because, you know, it was in the top three biggest fish in the country for quite a few years, that fat lady. It was a significantly large fish, obviously, that, you know, it was a popular lake. It's quite a big lake as well, so there'd been quite a few members waiting list to manage and all that. And I don't think, you know, I don't think he's ever going to retire rich from running a complex of lakes that he leases. You know, he doesn't own the land or anything. Now, I know once the fat lady passed away, yes, the shallow lagoon's always been a pretty decent fishery. You know, it's got a 50-pounder in there and a reasonable head of decent fish. So that's probably kept him afloat from going under, I would guess. But, you know, I know, I don't want to presume about somebody's financial status, but I do know he'd like to have sold a few more tickets than what he did, because he was very proactive advertising, you know, at carp shows and stuff. He's been to our show, I think. And I know it was a battle to maintain the running of these lakes, which in turn is for the benefit of anglers. It's one of the best complex of lakes in the country. It's in a beautiful area. It's extremely pleasant to fish. And the fish are just starting to come through. He made a stocking program to get the St. Ives Lagoon back to the sort of its former glory. Obviously, he hasn't got the 50-pounder in, but he's gone for getting, you know, a decent head of fish in there, because it's a fantastic lake, isn't it? A very interesting lake to fish. Well, it's almost like three lakes, really, isn't it? It's like the old lake, the new lake, and then you got the islands sort of section. It's fantastic.
I maintain, even with the bus route that was put in since we fished there, it is a perfectly shaped carp lake, and even it could be busy with a dozen anglers on, you weren't looking at another bivvy from anywhere you were. It was a fun lake to fish, even as hard as it was.
Yeah, and I think you can drive around it as well now, which makes life a lot easier. You certainly drive to a lot of the areas that were a bit of a bore lake. Yeah, a bit of a bore lake to fish. And it just seems to me that, you know, I was thinking, this is great now, you know, the lagoon's popular again in its own right. You know, it's got a decent head of sort of 30s in there, I think, these days. So a lot of the stockies have come through. And then I saw that picture today. So I just thought, what a kick in the bollocks that must be to Gordon after all the work he's put in there over the last 10 years. And he's now got an otter problem, clearly, that's already affecting some of his bigger fish in the lagoon. And it's not going to get any better, is it, this problem? And, you know, if you're leasing a lake, first of all, it's not your property. You know, you probably need planning permission and all sorts to fence it. Secondly, it's probably just not practical. He probably never see that money back in a lifetime, because he doesn't own the lake. So it's not like it's an asset he can sell at any point. He's just got the lease on it. If he loses the fish, that's it, finished. So it's, you know, there must be a lot of lake owners or people who lease lakes or complexes of lakes in that same boat, I would think. Yeah, you know what?
Yeah, definitely. One thing that does, that is frustrating, I've seen, not going to name them, but a couple of lakes, both with 50 pounders that are currently residing in there, they have put fences on, and those fences, well, the only way to describe them is absolutely effing useless. They're not going to stop a terry in the mind of an otter.
Yeah.
And the owners have done it, and they say, the both of them, you know, they say, oh, they think this, it's adequate, and it just isn't. I mean, you were down there. We were both on the wool pack when Andy fenced that, and that is an impressive fence. It was done properly.
Yeah, and he did that before the otter craze, before, you know, everybody was moaning about otters. He was very studious. Yeah, proactive. Yeah, before it was as big a problem as it is now. So as we know.
Yeah, we've both seen what a fence should be. And, you know, well, I'll take one example on gates. You know, the gate down, if I remember rightly, the Woolpack, it is underneath the gate when it's shut. It's like a log, or I think it's maybe an old railway sleeper. It's buried, so the otters cannot tunnel under it. And when the gate is shut, there's literally less than a centimetre's clearance, you know, even in the corners. And that's how
it should be. The gates should be meshed as well. I've seen lakes that have otter fenced it and they've not meshed the bloody gates.
Yeah, exactly the same. And there's one of these lakes in question. The gate is, it's got a bit of mesh apart from a great big hole in where you stick your hand through to open it, which the otter can just climb through. But along the bottom of the gate, so, you know, at least there's some cover and it touches the floor, is just a bit of old, I don't know, not tarpaulin. It's slightly thicker, but it's no better than a draft excluder.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, but so what's that? Just lazy fishery owners just thinking, oh, I've done something, there you go, I did it on the cheap, bodge job. And just it's obviously not to stop the otters coming in, because it ain't going to stop them. So it's
cutting corners, it's lip service to keep members happy, but I know on at least one of those lakes the members are far from happy, but I don't know if anyone's actually going to say anything, because it's an expensive ticket they've invested in, and they don't want to upset the owner, because he's going to tell you to F off. That's what
the problem is once they've got no fish left, they've got no business anymore. But as we have seen happen, you know, some less scrupulous fishery owners sometimes lie about their stock, or certainly, you know, the stock disappearing or vanishing, you know. How many lake owners have you known where one of the biggest fish in the lake, one of the fish that people join the lake to catch, has gone missing, that's, you know, later come to light that it had died, been found, and kept quiet? You know, the death of it. I mean, that's not uncommon. I've heard that a few times, including lakes I've joined. Yeah, that's happened.
Yeah, I can think of at least one example of that up in the north.
Yes. You know, I understand that the fish are worth money, but, you know, any fishery owner that's kind of surviving off one fish, you know, it's probably not a great business developer anyway, because, you know, you've got to plan for the future, haven't you? You know, you need to think ahead, not just short term, you know. Much like Gordon's done with St. Ives, you know, he's got the fish in there, they're just starting to come good now, and he's probably going to have an ongoing battle with otters. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Roger and I saw an otter on the lagoon while the lady was still alive, which is quite a few years ago now. In fact, it was the session that I caught a lady, in fact, my last session on there. We saw it was there was a mother and two young living on the island, but we did report it at the time. They went out to the island and said they couldn't find any evidence of them, but it was definitely 100% an otter. Both saw it multiple times.
Just behind that bank where you were fishing that time, around the day stream, you have what they call the Chub Stream, which is like a little offshoot of the Great Ouse, which was again only another 100 yards behind you. And I think otters have always been in that area.
Yeah, without a doubt.
But, I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast before, but I had an interesting chat with a Babel bloke not so long back. And he was saying, why if rivers like, you know, the Wye, the Severn, and particularly the Trent up near me, still fishing their absolute nuts off for big Babel, and the otters seemingly not affecting them?
Babel are pretty fast fish, aren't they?
Well, there's when the swimming is the flow, but, you know, the British record, the Traveller was done from the Great Ouse by a barbel a few years back, a 21-pound barbel. But now, what the explanation I was told was that the otters have always been there. The otters that are resident on the, you know, the aforementioned rivers, are the they're not the hand-reintroduced otters. They are the very territorial and vicious otters that have, you know, a very, very long territory range. So the river can sustain a pair of otters when that two otters covers a large part of river. Another couple of otters come into that territory, then it's on, then it's fight time. Not nowadays with these reintroduced otters. They see another otter, they've been raised with cuddly little otters. It's not a fight time, it's not invading the territory, it's a playmate. That's why these, like the River Hull, I know there's a ridiculous amount of otters. And they're all friends. I think things will come, you know, I don't know how long, but it will come full circle, and the otters that are out there in the wild now, they will become territorial again, and they will balance out. But in the meantime, fisheries suffering after fence.
Hmm. And it's interesting. I mean, we're not done with this otter debate, I'm sure. I'd like to get a couple of people who know a little bit more. Still waiting for someone from the Angling Trust to actually, or the EA. We've had a couple of people over the 2.5 years we've been doing this podcast contact us from the EA, saying they would like to come on and talk with us, but they need approval from their bosses before they speak publicly. And then nothing ever materialises, which can only mean one thing, that they're being told that they can't speak publicly. You know, people wanting to come and put a positive spin about all the good things that they do, and it's a shame that the EA won't allow that, you know, their employees to speak publicly. I'm guessing it's because it's a government body and they're scared of saying the wrong thing. But talking of the EA, when we spoke, it's something that I've kind of fell into here a little bit, that I'm now becoming a little bit passionate about, and this is about developing youth into fishing. If you remember, I spoke we spoke a couple of times, spoke with Kevin when we interviewed Kevin a couple of weeks ago about, you know, trying to get more youth into the sport. There's a lot of types of angling that are dying out at the minute, you know, especially the more pleasure fishing, float fishing, match fishing is really struggling currently. You know, it seems to be a very aged type. I'm not talking about carp match fishing, just talking about conventional match fishing. There's no youth coming into the match fishing scene. I know a lot of them, you know, from working with the Northern Angling Show, a lot of the match companies are very concerned about, you know, their area market share is declining rapidly. They're losing some to carp fishing, and just they're not getting the new people into match fishing. We've had meetings with Northern Angling Show with a number of the match companies, you know, saying what can we do to promote it. And it's led on to be talking to Kevin. We spoke at length, you'll have heard in the last show, talking about, you know, working with Israeli Angling Club, which is a local angling club to him, getting the junior section going, trying to do it. And I've had a few people contact me. I know Heapy Bob, social media guy for Carpcast, and all round nice fella. He is a school teacher. He's been looking into maybe getting some sorts of schemes going, but looking at the problems associated with it, and one of the main problems is parents see it as a way just to ditch their kids and get free babysitting, you know, when anything like this goes on, as opposed to actually supporting the kids with the fishing. It's much more success rate of kids staying in fishing if they go fishing with a parent or guardian. Anyway, in the meantime, we've been discussing this, and I keep getting emails from people who are working as part of EA schemes and stuff. Originally contacted by one of the southern guys, he's put me in touch with a northern counterpart, chap. Is it called James? Haven't got the email up. I don't want to click buttons now while we're recording, but suffice to say that there are a lot of things going on. There are. It's a big hurdle to overcome, and it's something that I think is beneficial for everybody to, you know, keep young people coming in, whether it be that they don't turn to a life of crime because they get a passion. You know, fishing saved many a person that I know from an otherwise more unsavory life, you know, which in turn affects us all. It might be your house that doesn't get broken into because, you know, the local hoodlums have developed a passion for something way more positive than crime or whatever. And it could be as simple as that. It could be that you actively would like to help. And I think we're looking at trying to get something going with the support from the schemes that the EA are doing, even if it's just making people aware that these schemes are out there, because I didn't know, and there is stuff going on. You know, the facts and figures that we had in one of the last emails, the guy was a little bit put out that we weren't really aware there were schemes going, and they'd had thousands of people attend these schemes over the last 12 months, and yet, you know, none of us had heard of it, not Kevin Nash, not myself, the other people. So if it's something you're interested in, if you're listening to this going, yeah, I'm up for, you know, helping, supporting, we don't quite know what it is. We've got a couple of plans, to be totally truthful. We've I've just found an email, actually. I've gone against what I'm saying. I'm a hypocrite as usual. But yeah, it's, there was Dean Asplin who initially contacted me. He's put us in touch with his northern counterpart, who's a guy called James Roche, or Roche, works for Partnership Development Manager North for the Angling Trust. So these are people that actually work for the Angling Trust. And they run a number of schemes. Let's Go Family Fishing is one of them. But the fact that a lot of people haven't even heard about these schemes, including myself and many other people I've spoken to in the industry, then maybe we can just help by making people aware of these schemes. But yeah, well, you got any thoughts on getting kids into fishing? I mean, working in a tackle shop, Mark, I'm guessing you know... I've just got a text off you. I don't know if I can talk anymore, literally.
I know, I've just been sat here cross-legged thinking I'm going to have to go. I've just sent my counterpart off in Blackpool a text saying keep going, got to piss, and then he introduces me again. I'll tell you what, just pause it, I'm going to have to go. One sec.
And he's back. So have you any thoughts working in a tackle shop? Have you noticed a decline in young people coming in? Or
there is. Well, I've been working in a tackle shop for just a little over 3 years, so I've not noticed anything over that time. But I know you're right when you say, particularly on the match and course side of things, there's a decline of recruitment of young anglers. And I think anybody, any company in the industry, the future of the business relies on new anglers coming into there. So... it is a no-brainer, really, to support these EA things. And, you know, Heapy Bob actually forwarded me the same email that you've been reading. I was reading about all these things, and I was like, why do I know nothing about this?
Yes.
I'm a qualified coach with the Angling Trust, and I know nothing about this.
Yeah, this is the point. It's all very well, like, I mean, maybe this is a typical government... bureaucracy type issue. The fact is, maybe they give X amount, hundreds of thousands of pounds for these things. Maybe they don't put enough importance in marketing to let people know about this stuff. Because, as I said, we all are working within the industry. We had the same conversation with Kevin Nash, who basically said this is rubbish. And, you know, I gave him the facts and figures, and he was very open to listening. And I know he's keen to support. It's a passion of his. Again, we should all, as business owners within the fishing industry, you know, especially the Northern Angling Show is my, you know, the Carpcast is fun, but the Northern Angling Show is, you know, the actual business that me and two other people rely on to live for our wages every year. And if no more kids, you know, if there isn't a new, you know, it's like a fish farmer stocking lakes. If you haven't got a group of new fish coming through, you know, when your old ones die, there's no more lake. And it's the same in everything. You need the youth coming through, and certainly in fishing. And there is a notable decline in coarse fishing. Some of it's because carp fishing's become so popular. But even so, I mean, carp fishing is not a very good entry level. Because of the cost of carp fishing, the cost of syndicates, day tickets, you know, most places are 20 quid plus a day to fish. If you're a 12-year-old, 13-year-old kid, as I was, you know, when I had a paper round trying to afford a bag of boilies, you know, you now need two rods, two alarms, two reels, you know, bait at £10 a kilo, £20 a day to go fishing. You can't do that off a paper round. Like, carp fishing is not a good stay. It's a great style of fishing to grow into, but it's not a good style of fishing to start off at, like as an entry level. You know, it's super cheap, you know, a cheap little 10-foot match rod, fiberglass rod, whatever, and a reel and a box of maggots, you know, is within anybody's remit. And that's where you get, and not to mention you become a better angler by learning how to float fish, you know, by watching the water. You know, I get a lot of messages asking me about watercraft, and while you can give somebody pointers to good watercraft, you know, much the same as maybe a good hunter could teach you things to look for in the forest or whatever, like, there's no better way than learning through experience and doing it yourself and working things out yourself. And you know, so many people bypass that in fishing. There's no it's no coincidence that some of the best anglers, that the top 1%ers, as we call them, out there are all, you know, they've all had experience before they were carp fishing. They've all had fishing experience before. There's not many that went straight in as a carper. You know, they learn how to fish for other species. Yeah, because it's all part of a puzzle we're trying to solve. And not to mention, for all the reasons we've mentioned before, not just to sustain, you know, the fishing ecology, the business side of it, but just for, it's a good thing for kids to have a passion that's healthy, you know, not a video game, or, you know, that's in nature, it's outside. Because fishing's taught me respect for other things, you know. It taught me, I would never throw a sweet wrapper down or a chocolate wrapper or whatever onto the floor anymore. Well, I know I did as a kid, but when you live in that environment, you know, a significant amount of your time, you know, I mean, you spend 3 nights a week fishing, you're spending nearly half your life out in nature. You notice when somebody's left rubbish behind, or, you know, and it annoys you. Now, until you've been in that position, next time you've got that sweet wrapper or cigarette butt or whatever it is, and you just used to throw it down without even thinking, you know, it trained even little things like that. It gave me respect for nature, just because you're spending so much time in it. And then it annoys you with other people not respecting it. So there are so many levels where it's good for people to, you know, to take up fishing, amongst many other outdoor pastimes. But anything we can do to support that, I think, is great. And maybe it is just a communication thing with the Angling Trust. Maybe they're doing the right things, but not enough people know about it.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. You know, they do seem to be going a lot in the right direction, and but the communication does seem to be lacking. And I think it might be time for a Hughes News sooner or later, because obviously Rob Hughes is connected with the Angling Trust. He was kind of a bit of an ambassador role for between carp anglers and them. You know, he's a
yes, certainly. We need Rob on anyway. Last time we spoke to Rob was about England stuff, but yeah, some sort of general stuff. I know Rob is a Mr. Man in all sort of, got his fingers in all sorts of official pies. Dean and James are both in touch with us. They can help us in several ways. They said if we get stuff going, you know, there is funding available for angling initiatives. They can also find volunteers and licensed coaches near us, which, again, Mark, you're a licensed coach. How many times have you been approached to do something like this?
Exactly. Never. Although I will qualify that by saying my license has lapsed.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I do need to. If I do intend on doing any coaching, I do need to renew that. But even that's easier said than done. It means renewing my CRB check, going on another first aid course, going on another safeguarding course, and then renewing the license.
Yeah, they can.
All of which are totally necessary.
They can help with insurance costs as well. They can waiver the rod license for these courses, so people can get a taste of it without having to buy a rod license or break the law. And they can offer two types of educational angling courses, links to sustainable exit routes such as local angling clubs, commercial fisheries near to, you know, schools or whatever, and loads more. So there is stuff they can do. It looks like the Angling Trust have got stuff set up for this. Maybe it needs some people proactive to help out. Maybe you're a school teacher, maybe you think something could be done in your area. Let's get in touch. Let's try and get something going. A little more official and maybe nationwide, because that's the thing. Just because somebody's doing something decent in one area doesn't mean that, you know, it needs to happen nationally, I think, to have any sort of long-term effect. And it does benefit everybody. I can picture now some miserable old carper sat there thinking, I don't want my lakes any more busy. It's not like it was 20 years ago and it's too busy now. You know, we can all picture that type of angler, can't we, Mark? We've...
Yeah, we can do, although getting kids into fishing is not about carp fishing. It's about getting on a seat box, and the carp they could be catching is from a commercial where they're catching one a chuck and actually learning to the fish, learning the handling of the fish, learning a bit of watercraft.
Yeah.
not sitting behind buzzers vegetating.
Yeah, definitely. So it's a case of watch this space. The point of me mentioning this now is just to see if there's anybody out there that's interested in being proactive and doing something there, because whatever area you are in, maybe we can just be the catalyst and connect people, you know, maybe under some sort of official angling trust umbrella. I mean, we have the northern counterpart and the southern counterpart now that we are in touch with, and I know Heapy Bob is very keen as a school teacher. You know, who's interested in fishing. I know he's very keen to get something going. So watch this space, I think. But yeah, if you are interested in getting involved in any way whatsoever, whether it be funding, whether it be offering time, or whatever, or maybe you have a venue you're prepared to give up for a day a month that we could use in any area of the country, anything, because again, if you do own a venue, some sort of lake, maybe you have a quiet day, maybe the first Monday of the month's really quiet and you wouldn't mind giving it up in a school holiday or whatever, these people are your future customers, you know, long term. So if there is any way you would like to support the scheme that we don't know what it quite is yet, but we do know that the Angling Trust are now involved talking to us, so it will be official, then please do offer your services. It's myself, to Heapy Bob online, to Mark, to anybody in there. Let's get everybody together. It's 5 to 9, Mark, and we're going to get our guest in very shortly, but more importantly, Louis Theroux's on in a minute. So,
oh wow, and I've got an article to finish off before I go to bed as well.
It's been a while since I've written an article.
So yeah, it's been about a week since the last one.
You're always a bit more studious on the writing than me. You enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I'm blessed. I actually do find writing in the written English quite, it flows, it comes natural. The only thing is I can't add up. That's the payoff. Feels like I'm in love. Just like the first time I met you.
So I'd like to welcome a man to the Carpcast that is a beast of a man, I believe, a man that can chuck a lead like no other. He's in the England squad purely for his beasting abilities, I believe, according to Rob Hughes. So please welcome to the Carpcast, Mr. Kyle Pitchers. How you doing, pal?
Yeah, good, Jamie. You?
Yeah, not too bad at all. I believe you've been away relaxing, have you, this week?
Yeah, I've just took the missus away for a couple of days down to the Cotswolds. It was her birthday, so I thought I'd treat her for a weekend away. She's been a bit patient with all the stuff with England and that, so I treated her to a couple of days away.
Was it? Do you manage to get yourself near a piece of water to look at?
We did go for a little wander, but we was in a spa, to be honest, so we was just sort of chilling out, to be honest, for having some nice food and just relaxing, really.
Yeah, so there's some cracking water around there. The whole water park's got a lot of carp. A lot of carp and a lot of crayfish, I believe. But some fantastic waters around there.
Yeah, it's a lovely part of the country down that way. So
so where are you from? Where do you hail or where are you based?
I'm from a little town called Watton in Norfolk, near Norwich, not about half an hour from Norwich. Sort of out in the sticks, really. So I've been fairly used to travelling for my fishing now for the last 7 or 8 years.
And I mean, I always picture Norfolk having quite a bit of fishing because of the Broads, but is it not too much on the carp front, or?
There's a few waters in Norfolk, but I mean obviously you've got the Norfolk Broads, and it's a bit scandalous really that I'm from Norfolk but I've never actually fished them. Wow. Which is a bit crazy really, but yeah, I mean, there's all sort of like the syndicate waters around, and I sort of fished around Norfolk for a few years, and then decided to sort of start going a bit further afield to sort of chase the bigger fish, I guess.
So where did it start for you? Like, how did you first pick up a fishing rod?
I started back when I was a kid. A little place called Lochneaton in Watton, the town that I'm from. just a little junior club water. Back then it was just a little red fiberglass rod going down there with my dad and just basically catching whatever I could with a quarter of a pint of maggots. And you know, back then it was like if you could catch a tench, like you'd had a great day's fishing. You know, you was catching little perch that was eating the maggots so far down, you know, the scourger to get them out every time. Yeah. And just sort of went from there, really.
And where did you come across carp then? How did that that grab
it
you?
It was at Loch Neaton, really. Like I said, the place there, just again float fishing. There was the odd big carp in there. Well, I say big carp, it was probably like 8-9 pound back then. But and it just again sort of just fishing for, you know, roach and bream on the float rod, and then all of a sudden, you know, you get the carp on. You didn't quite know what was going on, and then I think from that moment when that first happens, it grabs you, and you then automatically want to start catching them regular.
And where did the match fishing come in? Did you sort of course match fish when you were young?
Yeah, I did. I done some junior matches, like I said on the lake that I just mentioned. That was sort of in the early days, and I'd sort of done a bit of all fishing when I was a kid. Done quite a bit of fly fishing as a kid as well, and so then got into the carp fishing. Match fishing sort of took a back seat until about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I started doing the British Championships with Cliff Kemp. And it's just sort of gone from then. I had a phone call from Rob Hughes, and ever since then it's become a lot more serious.
So I know you've got a ticket on Grenville, is it?
Yeah, Grenville, yeah.
Which is known for its big, open, vast sort of space. You have a definite advantage on there if you can cast far. And then, you're known as a big chucker. Tell us how you've refined your techniques. I mean, what sort of rigs are you using to get that distance? When did you realise you could cast further than everybody else? Just give us an insight into the... And when you realised that was an advantage for you?
To be honest, it was never really sort of stand out from the start. I went on to Grenville. I'd never fished. I'd come from Norfolk fishing fairly small waters up to sort of like, you know, 15 acres or something like that. And then I remember the first time I walked around Grenville, I did think to myself, what am I letting myself in for? Absolutely, you know, 75 acres. And now it doesn't look that big. But when I first went on there, you know, it is a real big water, and you also get the you know, the real strong winds and that up there. And I guess I got on there and I saw the people that were catching where we're fishing, you know, over large beds of bait and fishing a little bit further out. So I just got myself a set of casting rods and just went for it, really. I didn't have lessons. I just sort of slowly just worked my way up with it.
Right, and then so what sort of ranges can you cast?
Fishing at Grenville, because there's certain rules with leaders and stuff that you can't use leaders that are tied onto the line. Yeah. You can't use braided leaders. So you're sort of using like the tapered mono lines and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm fishing at 160 quite regular.
Yeah, that's with what, hook bait and being able to bait up at that range.
Yeah, hook bait and baiting up with a large spawn as well, yeah.
Which I'm looking at getting some tapered leaders. There seems to be two at the minute, the Fox one and the Corder one. Is there a preference?
Yeah. Personally, I like the Fox one. I've never really used the Corder one. I've always used the Fox one. And that's just what it's just the same as anything. When you're used to using something, you just sort of carry on and don't change. But yeah, I've that's what I use.
And is that a sort of maximum? Is it the line that's restricting you with that chucking distance? If you needed to go further and there was no bands, what would you be using?
Depending on obviously weed and that in the lake. If it was gin clear, no weed, very little snags, I'd go down to as low as 0.26 mono with a braided leader, 65 pound braided leader.
Right.
And that makes a massive difference with braid, because you know when you're casting, there's no stretch in the braid, and obviously it loads the rod quicker.
Ah, yeah, that's a very good point. And so, what diameter is the thin bit of these tapered leaders? That's got to be around 0.26, is it?
No, it's point. It's quite thick. It's 0.30. I think they do it. They do two. There's one that's 0.30, and then they do one that's 0.33 as well. So I tend to use the thinner one, but it's still £15, I think. So it's still quite a thick lime, you know. So you don't really want to go down too thin, and you obviously start getting cut off and stuff. It's not really.
And have you got a preference on the 0.26? If I need to cast really far, what should I be buying?
I've been using in the World Championships. I was using the 8-pound Technium.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, which is obviously known to be a very strong line in itself. So that seems to work really well, to be honest. That's what I use.
I guess with it being so thin, it's quite stretchy as well. Is it all right for landing fish with it being quite thin? You're not really getting any trouble.
I think, to be honest, I've had a chat with a few people about it. I think people get a bit, when they hear you say sort of, you know, 6-8 pound line, people sort of freak out about it. But as long as you're aware of it, and obviously you make sure you've got your clutch set nice and loose, or backwind or whatever you use, as long as you're aware of it, it doesn't really cause you any problems. It's only obviously if you're fishing very weedy lakes or snaggy lakes that obviously I'd up the main line, but it doesn't really cause you any problems, to be honest.
Are you using 13-foot rods as well?
Yeah, 13-foot rods. Yeah, 13-foot rods just gives a bit more forgiveness in the tip as well. So,
yeah,
and I can't. Yeah, like I said, I don't think I've ever actually had a 12-foot casting rod. So, that's what I've always used.
Yeah. Yes, I'm moving abroad next year. I'm going to fish a lot over in Slovenia and Croatia, and there's quite a lot of long chucking over there, which there's no weed in a lot of the lakes. So it's perfect for that sort of gear. There is snag, so you get rocks and sunken trees and stuff. So I'm asking a lot of these questions personally for me because
I think it's just trying to find that happy medium, isn't it? To try and obviously have the kit light enough to still obviously not cut the distance down, but obviously still putting the fish on the bank.
Yeah, and I know you use the sort of solid PVA bag approach as well, do you? Is that more for the matches? Or?
No, to be honest, I don't hold any secrets within fishing. If someone walks into my peg, I'm the most open angler there is. Yeah. You know, I don't ever try and hide anything. That's not who I am. And I use them at Grenville all the time when it's scratching for a bite. They've caught me, well, nicked me so many bites up there when, you know, they're just not really having it or something like that. And the solid bags they're brilliant. I use them wherever I can.
Talk us through how you make the bag, what's in it then, because again it's a tactic I don't use a lot, and I'm probably missing out, I think, on a lot of places. It can land anywhere, definitely. Can it?
Definitely. In a way, if there's too many tench or bream, they're almost too effective,
right.
If that makes sense, because you've just got that little pile of food on the bottom with a small hook bait. So if there is bream and tension there, you know, you'll soon find out, because generally you'll get a bite pretty quickly from them.
And so talk us how you make the bags. Do you have to get them really tight? I always worry with them coming open, you know, when you're going for like an extreme cast. If I want to make a little bag and blast it to the horizon, tell us how to do it so it's foolproof.
Yeah, well, basically micro pellet. I don't tend to use anything bigger than 2 mil. If I have got something bigger than 2 mil in there, I'll also have some ground bait or salmon fry crumb in there, so it just fills all the gaps when you're tying the bag.
Yeah.
I'll put just a small amount of pellet in the bottom, about a quarter of the bag, then drop the lead in. I then put the hook bait in, hold it at the top of the bag to one side, and then I carry on filling the bag up with a pellet, and then basically just put the hook bait in, fill it all the way to the top, tap the bag with your hand so it just gets nice and compact, and then just tie it off with PVA tape, and then double bag. Obviously fold the corners down and double bag it. That's what makes the real difference. If you, obviously what solid bags you use as well makes a bit of a difference, because some of them, when you're really trying to manipulate the bag to make it nice and tight, they can sometimes split.
Yeah.
So, and I think,
are you licking it and twisting it around the sort of top? Are you using a little inline lead, are you?
Yeah, a little inline drop off. I know some people, some of the other match lads use like the long tail rubbers, and they just lick it and stick it around the top. I tend to tie mine off with just PVA tape.
Yeah.
It's just personal preference on that, obviously, but that's just how I like to do it.
And what are the best bags and what tape do you use?
The tape, I use the Fox tape on them, and I've used quite a few. The best bags that I've found for distance work, because they're so tough, believe it or not, the Tacklebox own brand bags.
Yeah.
They're called TB Smart Bags, and the micro version, they're so tough. I've never had one split tying a bag. So it's just all them little things that when I was initially getting into solid bag fishing, I went through all the bags splitting halfway through tying them up, and in the end I've just sort of got a few different makes that I use, and you never have any problems. So
When I pull the PVA tape type, it always stretches and snaps on me. Am I just using too thin a tape, or?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I tend to go for the, sometimes as well, what I do with the PVA tape is I double it up before you tie it.
Yeah.
So you've got like twice the thickness of it, and then you don't have problems with it snapping.
And when you double bag it, so you just make this bag, tie it off, then you just slip it inside another bag and do the same thing again. Do you twist it and tie it off?
Yeah, basically that's it. Yeah, so just put the second bag on, just pop the corners, and then just stick the corners down, and I really try and make it as tight as possible. I really stretch the bag over the top, and when they're tied, the bags are rock hard. And also as well, which makes the bag hard is adding some sort of oil to the bag when you're tying it up as well.
Right. Have you got a preference? You change it through the year when the water gets colder and stuff?
Yeah, I do. Yes, you know, fish oils in the summer, and then, you know, it depends where I'm fishing as well in the matches, you know. Might put a bit of gooey in the bags as well, you know, just sort of mix it up, really. I think the best thing is the bag itself, is that presentation with a short hook link and a heavy lead. It doesn't tangle. Yeah. I think that's what makes it so good.
Yeah, it seems like a great method. I mean, I remember back to the old sort of PVA bag days 20 years ago, where they had these big clunky things, and if you cast them in, the wind took them, and, you know, I was quite an accurate sort of spot fishing, and I got put off them, I think, but I really see the benefit of them these days, and just a little ball of attraction to get some oil in there. Do you think liquids make a massive difference to getting that quick bite in the match?
I think they can on match fishing. I think they can as well in deep water as well.
Why deep water?
Well, I mean, if the fish are perhaps up in the water, you know, and you want to try and draw them down, and that might sound a bit of a gimmick, but I've seen it before on Grenville. I've cast the bag out, felt the lead down to the bottom, the bag's broken down, I've seen a slit come up to the top, then obviously you know the bag's melted. Yeah. Sat there just watching the water. Hour later, I see a slit come up over where the bag's been cast, and then I get a bite.
Yeah, so you know something's just disturbed it on the bottom.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you got any secrets for what you feed in, you know, for instant bites? Do you find that, like the sort of little and often, do you think fish are attracted to the spawn or in deeper water or whatever?
It's not something that I've done on Grenville previously, but since I've been doing the matches, I seem to be doing it more and more now in sort of my own fishing as well. I used to just put a bed of bait out, say have two or three bites off it, and then top up afterwards. But I've now just tend to top it up little and often. And when you watch like the other lads that I fish with in the England side, you know, Kev Hewitt, Mark Bartlett, Tom Maker, all them guys, they fish like that all the time. And
yeah.
I just think when you watch it and you see how they fish and you see how it works, I think you just think, well, you know, I'll try that in my own fishing, and that's what I've started to do, to be honest.
Yeah, I did a little bit of that in Croatia last year. They all fish like that over there. I mean, I'm sure you've come across like the Croatian team and stuff
while on
the travels, and that's how they fish. I mean, when I was over there, I put a load of bait in from the boat, because you could use a boat there, so I went up. There's a lot of fish in this particular lake. I put about 15 key in from the boat, and we didn't really catch that night. No bites overnight. 6 o'clock the next morning, we're up at first light, started spomming, and bear in mind there was already bait there. Within 5-10 minutes of started spomming, we were getting bites, me and my pal, both of us, and a pattern came. Literally, it doesn't matter what bait was already out there, as soon as you started spomming, you got a bite, and if you didn't spom, you didn't get a bite. And I watched, as you said, all the guys you just mentioned who seem to fish like that wherever they go, orchid or whatever, and they always catch well. And I'm wondering if it harmed me putting a load of bait in at the start, whether I should just be feeding constantly from the off. I mean, have you witnessed the same thing?
I do now. I think, to be honest with you, I think it's more important to bait application in terms of little and often and how accurate you are, as opposed to just sort of tanking in a load of bait at the start. I think if you can just keep it going in, I think definitely the sound of the spod on your sort of day ticket type waters, they're definitely attracted to it. And when you see, like I said, the guys I just mentioned, how they fish on linear or somewhere like that, how accurate they fish, and fishing 3 rods on a spot is impressive to watch it, I have to say. And
Have you used some of these techniques on Grenville then? Because Grenville seems like the perfect sort of lake to do that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's how I have been fishing it in the last sort of couple of months, really. I haven't fished Grenville a great deal this year because I've been busy with the matches, but I've done a few trips up there the last couple of months, and I've been just baiting little and often.
Yeah. And what have you had out of Grenville? The stocking there seems to be something special, doesn't it?
It is. It's an amazing place. I've had a ticket on there for a long time. But I just keep going back. I just love the style of fishing. I love everything about it down there, to be honest. But I think I've done the start of this season. I've done about 8 nights, and I think I've had about 8 30s, 2 or 3 40s, and a 50. So,
wow!
When you look at it like that, I mean, it's pretty amazing, really.
How many 50s are in there now? Because they seem to be growing like mad.
I think different 50s that are recorded, there's about 8 or 10. I might be wrong. It's around that figure, but I mean, some of the fish's growth rates are ridiculous. I mean, there could be a fish couple that was 42 pound last year. It could come out now, and it's 51. It wouldn't surprise me at all. Some of the fish are putting on crazy weights.
Yeah, that is crazy. I mean, are you going to? I know the owner over there. When you arrive on a session, you can get him to drop a pile of bait out there in the boat. I mean, are you going to? Based on what we're sort of just saying about the little and often, are you still going to get him to put a bit out when you get there, or are you just going to bait constantly through a session?
To be honest, since I got in the England side as well, I have been spotting every time I've been, just purely for practicing spotting at long range.
Yeah.
I used to use the boat, but now obviously with the matches and stuff, and I want to practice, I do spot on every session. To be honest, I don't use the boat at all.
What are you using for your spod setup? Do you use braided mainline?
Well, no, yeah, I've actually just changed. I used to use braid. And I think I've tried every braid under the sun. You know, they are good, but I've just found when you're fishing at long range, if you can limit the dramas that you have with wind knots and stuff,
yeah,
it just makes it much more enjoyable. Sometimes, you know, you put a new braid on and you might have 5 casts, and the first 3 casts you got wind knots on because it's brand new braid. Until it beds down, braid is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've had the same sort of problem, but...
Yeah.
So now I've got, again, I just use the same line that I use for my fishing. If I'm fishing somewhere like, you know, that you can use a braided leader, I just use 8 pound Technium with a 65 pound shock leader, braided shock leader.
Yeah.
And it's made no difference in terms of distance at all. None. So it's a no-brainer for me. I'm going to be using mono from now on, definitely.
I think I am after what you're just saying there. I've used braid, I was used like Power Pro or something, just one of the pretty thin ones. It's like a 6 pound Power Pro on my spod rod, and but obviously still need a leader with it, cause it's super thin, but it can go hitting the clip sometimes. You hit the clip hard, so
I think with monos, you know, if you're fishing at long range and you're hitting the clip hard with a big spot, it's worth perhaps just check in the lead or not before you start every session, but I mean, that's about all you really need to do. I haven't had one touch wood, because this is going to be a kiss of death. I've not had one wind knot since I've been using mono or one crack off. So for me, it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah. And what knots are you using to join, like the braid leader to thin mono?
I don't know whether it's a knot that you should recommend, but I use a 4-turn water knot.
Right, so...
It's just something that I've always used, and I've never had any problems with it going or anything. That's what I use. I use, again, from fly fishing, that's just a knot I like to use.
Yeah.
Or back-to-back blood knot or grinner, but I generally use a 4-turn water knot.
What's that, where you, like, bend... do you bend the mono and then whip the braid down it and back through the...
No, that's an Albright. Four-turn water knot is when you just lay... You put the braid against the mono...
Yeah.
Create a loop, and then you just go through with both tag ends 4 times.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it's just real simple knot to tie, and as long as you're a bit careful bedding it down, it's absolutely perfect. So that's why it's just nice and easy.
Yeah, I use that knot for combi rigs, for just using for actual hook links. But you got any other tips you can give us for anything you picked up during the match fishing or fishing with the other guys that might get us a few extra bites?
I think it's just trying to, you know, keep your eyes open, and I think people fall into a trap of just sort of copying everyone else as well, especially on the old day ticket waters and stuff. It's just, you often see it as well on syndicate waters when you see a new member go onto a lake where they go against the grain. They perhaps fish a different swim that's not popular, do something a bit different, and sometimes the new members can do really well on waters because they're just doing something that they, you know, they're not getting stuck in the trap of following the crowd. And I think just being active with your fishing, and don't just sit back and wait for it to happen. If you feel that you should have had a bite, yeah, ring the changes. If you're fishing somewhere like Light Linear, a couple of spots over the top, or changing a rod to a zig, or a fresh solid bag, you know, a bag past the spot, a bag short of it, anything like that can sometimes nick you a fish when it's a bit scratchy. Just keep working at it, basically. I don't think there's a you know, like a perfect like method or anything. You just got to work at it and just try and read the lake as best you can.
So if you're fishing like a linear or somewhere, you're on St. John's, it's not fishing that great, or maybe you're not bang on them, you've had your rods out 24 hours, nothing's happened, like what's the first thing you would change? Like hook bait colour or smell, or like what would you be looking to nick that bite?
Well, it would depend. If I had obviously fish showing on me and I was fishing on the bottom and I hadn't had a bite, I'd put all 3 rods out on zigs without a doubt. But I wouldn't just throw a zig out as well. You really were zig fishing, and I'm not claiming I'm the best zig angler on the planet, but it's something that you've got to work out. So many people, I think, just throw a token zig out, and that's not really the way to do it. You've got to work at it to get the best out of it. Definitely,
that's me, just one rod out of the zig half hide, and I still catch probably more for the rod hours of zigs in the water. I probably catch way more than I do off the bottom. So talk us through, alright, you're changing all your rods to zigs, you've not got a bite, you think there's fish in the area. Tell us that where you'd start off. Are you fishing, you know, what colour foam are you flavouring it, what depth would you start off at in relation to the water, what's your start, and then what would you do to keep tweaking?
I would start, say if I was fishing on B1 somewhere like that, for example, I'd probably have one rod, fishing about 14 foot of water, I'd probably have one rod at 9 foot, one at 7, one at 5.
Right.
Mix the colours up, red, black, and just give it an hour, set your clock, set your alarm, and just keep working it that way. But I don't think, you know, again, there's no holy grail, it's what working on the day. Probably on somewhere like B1, I probably would spot over zigs as well.
Yeah.
But other lakes, single zigs work better. It just depends, you've just got to sort of try it and work it out, really.
Are you using zigger liners and foam for your sort of hook baits, or do you ever use little pop-ups or anything? Or
I don't tend to, I'll sometimes use a pop-up if I'm fishing, say, a murkier water, where the water's not very clear, I might use something on as a bit of smell, but generally it's just a piece of foam, unflavoured.
I virtually never put any other colour out other than black, so I'm interested when you say you'd go to red fairly early on
I think at Linear, the reason that red used to work so well is because obviously there's a maggot ban on Linear now, but there never used to be. And I think red worked so well purely and simply because of the amount of maggots that used to get spotted in.
Yeah.
And, you know, when maggots were allowed on there, spotting maggots over zigs used to be absolutely deadly on there.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good. They fall through the water quite slowly. I hadn't really thought that of spotting maggots. If I ever make a spod mix for Zig, I'll just go for like a really sort of slushy ground baity type.
Maggots over dead. I used to use dead maggots, and dead maggots over Zigs on there used to be absolutely deadly. But obviously, like I say, you can't do it on there now. So,
do you ever use that? Is it like the Zig attached to the spod? You ever use that setup?
What one's that, sorry?
I think it was Billy and Jamie used to use it years ago. I've seen videos of them, but they had a spod set up or spom set up, but they had the zig attached to the spom, so they'd leave this, obviously cast it like a slow sinking sort of. They'd even use I think they called it a spodcopter or something.
Oh, spodcopter, yeah, use that for floater fishing as well, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, use it for floater fishing. Like places like Drayton Reservoir, use like the midi corder spod. And the spodocopter, it's devastating on places like that. It's absolutely brilliant. Because it's a bit like obviously you're putting your free offerings out with it, and also at the same time you're getting the bolt effect of the spod.
Yeah.
So you sort of got the best of both worlds with it.
So you're just using the spod as a controller, really.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And obviously you've got your loose feed around it with a little tiny hook bait. So yeah, that's a devastating method on sort of places like Drayton, high stock places.
Yeah, I'm guessing you're not using the big spod, just using like the tiny one.
The little tiny ones. I can't remember what they're called, but the little small quarter ones. Yeah,
yeah.
That's what a lot of the lads use for that.
Yeah, it's crazy some of the methods that the match guys are using. You know, carp anglers are so used to sitting in the swim, doing nothing, you know, redoing the rods every 24 hours. But I've said it for years, like the match anglers, even on the tough syndicate lakes, I think the match anglers would be doing better these days.
Go on. Yeah. No, sorry. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, since I've started doing the matches 3 years ago, I've had my eyes opened, and I'm confident doing things now that I wouldn't have been 5 years ago.
Yeah. Is it like what? Like all the things we've said, or is there anything else?
Like all the things we've said. Like I said, I was probably a bit like what you said with zig fishing in the past. I was never really that confident in it. I'd be like, perhaps throw a token zig out and it might go or it might not, but I never really used to work that hard on it. But I think the most important thing for people that are trying to improve on stuff like that, you need to be fishing the right waters where you can go and get plenty of bites to get your confidence up.
Mm.
It's no good trying it on I'm not saying it won't work on a hard syndicate water, but if you want to go and get your confidence on it, definitely go somewhere like Linear Brazenose 1 so you know that you've got a really good chance of catching on the method. And then you can start changing things around and you'll get confident in it then.
Yeah, I think that's what it needs, because it still is a bit out of the box for some people. I know it's been a long time now, things have been kind of commonplace. But if you turn up to a lake, you walk onto a well-stocked lake, you see fish showing in a swim, are you at the stage where you'd cast a zig before you cast a bottom bait to it, or would you cast a bottom bait first?
I'd probably... It depends what I knew about the lake, but to be honest, I'm probably still the sort of person that would still throw a bottom bait out. But if it was one of them where I could throw four rods out, I'd probably throw two out on the bottom and two on zigs. I'm not still massively. Obviously, I can catch fish on them, but I'm not. I haven't got the confidence in them like what Tom Maker would or someone like that, because he's been doing that sort of fishing for the last 10 years or more. So,
yeah. Yeah, I still think if we ditched bait for a year and we just fish cigs for a whole season, every time you went fishing, never took any bait with you, do you think you'd catch more or less in a year?
I was just thinking about the same thing myself. It would take a very brave angler to do it, but it'd be interesting to see what the result. I don't know. I think the zigs. I don't know, because there's certain times of the year where you got, like now, where the fish want a bit of bait. I'm not sure. It's a hard one. I don't think you'd catch any less fish, put it that way.
Yeah, that's my thought, because I think even if they are feeding on the bottom and they're hungry, they're still going to pick that zig up a few foot above the bottom, because they're in there picking the particles up from whatever they're feeding on the bottom on, and you know, disturbing it, and you're still going to get the bite anyway, even if they want bait on the bottom, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a few factors come into it as well, as obviously depth of the water, you know, water clarity and stuff like that as well. They're definitely better on certain lakes than others, definitely.
And have you found long range zig fishing? Have you done much of that? Have you found that they're really not expecting to be snaffled mid water at long distances?
Well, I mean, like again, brazenose, you're fishing up to 135 yards with zigs on there. Mm. But you know, further than that on other venues, I just think it all depends on where they are in the water column. Basically, I don't think it would. It might work on. I haven't really done loads of real long-range zig fishing in this country anyway, to be honest. Because the place that I'd really love to try it is Grenville, but it's banned on there. So, I think on there, when you've got, at this time of year, when you've got the sedges hatching off, it would be devastating. If you could find the right depths, I think it would be absolutely devastating on there.
So what's the plans for the future? You've got when's the next England thing? Or what's the next few months look like for you?
Well, this... Now, next few months will be perhaps another trip to Grenville. I've got another ticket on that I acquired this year, and I've still not been yet. So I might have a trip up there before Christmas. Might do a bit of fly fishing over the Christmas period. I always have a trip out with my old mate Jim, sort of Christmas time. Go up on Grafham Water for the day. It's a bit of a contrast to the old carp fishing.
What you're catching, is it trout?
Yeah, just catching rainbows and the odd brown if you're lucky. But I'll probably do just a bit of fishing now until Christmas, and then start again in the spring. I won't fish right. I might fish right through it. Depends how the weather is, to be honest.
Have you got any?
You won't see me out. Sorry.
Do you got any secret recipes for the trout? You take them home, cook them.
Yeah. Stuffed with a bit of. Rosemary, thyme, butter, garlic, salt and pepper, bake them in the oven. Lovely.
Yeah, just wrap them in, stuff them, wrap them
in foil. Wrap them in a bit of foil. Yeah, beautiful. I quite nice trout, to be fair. Nice bit of fishing as well.
Yeah, I'd like to have another fishing skill, where like fly fishing or something, where, I mean, carp fishing, it's you have to plan for a couple of days usually, and there's no waters around here where you can just shoot down for a few hours. Like, we're not that lucky up north to have anywhere that, you know, for short sessions. But I'd like to have another style of fishing that I could just go when I've only got an afternoon or something, and fly fishing could be it.
To be honest, it's an absolute. If you're obviously, like, you've been a carp angler for years, it's that contrast of you've got a small net, one bag, and just one rod, and it is something you can just think, well, I've got a couple of hours, I'll just pop off and do 2-3 hours. It's like, obviously, when you go carp fishing, like, I don't know about you, but I take so much kit, I can't justify going for just a couple of hours. So fly fishing's a good, to sort of get your fishing fix. It's really good in the winter as well, because you can just go for a day and you're still home in the warm in the evening, you know.
Fantastic. And if anybody wants to come to talk to you over the winter, you at any of these shows this year?
I think I might be at the Sandown show. I'll just go if I'm asked by anyone. Normally, Rob, I think we do one of the Sandown show, and also carping on as well. So, yeah, should be at one of the shows at some point, no doubt.
Are you consultancy wise? You with Fox, or what bait sort of deals have you got? I mean, who are you using?
I use mainline baits.
Yeah.
And I get my reels and rods off of Shimano. So, but yeah, that's pretty much it, really.
So everything else you use is just because it's the best sort of.
Yeah, I think you just get. Yeah, just basically the best tool for the job is what I use, to be honest. I think that's what probably the best way to be, you know. Right, I just use what works and what I'm confident in.
Well, best of luck on your winter fly fishing campaign, and I hope you bag a whacker out of Grenville, and thanks for talking to us on the Carpcast.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. Cheers, mate.
The Carpcast, in association with the Northern Angling Show, the North's biggest fishing event at Event City Manchester, 24th and 25th of February. For early entry and the cheapest tickets, visit northernanglingshow.co.uk.
So a big thank you to Carl Pitcher. Next week we've got more England superstars, if you can call them that. We've got the fantastic Mark Bartlett, who I've been trying to get for ages because I believe he's got some tips and tricks second to none, and I really want to hear about him. So yeah, next week will be Mark Bartlett. There, just before we go, I saw Hassan Khan. I watched he works for Angling Direct now, is it?
I believe so, yep.
And I watched him do a live stream the other day, actually, from Clearwater Fisheries, clearwaterfisheries.co.uk, who are actually the official sponsor of the Carpcast. I watched him do a live stream the other day from Clearwater. Jody Callan, was diving. I presume they were doing some filming from the new fish, but Hassan was staying in the lodge up at Clearwater with his family, and it looked fantastic. So I know you and your missus like a lodge holiday occasionally near a lake.
There's cap in the lake, and there's a hot tub for my wife to vegetate.
There's currently no hot tub. I know Alex, the owner of Clearwater, he has one in his garden, but through experience he says people like to drink in a hot tub, and drinking and warm water tends to create mess that costs money to clean, I think. So he hasn't got.
I think we've done other things in the hot tub. I've never urinated in one yet.
But I just think that having the booze, the sticky beer and stuff in there as well. I don't really know because I've never actually had a hot tub. But I did look at that lodge and think that's pretty much nicer than my house, my kitchen and everything I own. So I know Alex would have done it properly. But yeah, if I know you can book the lodge at Clearwater if you're after a holiday. And the work that's going on at Clearwater at the minute, I watched the fish going in at the weekend. It's just making one of the best complexes in the country. If you are interested, I know the syndicate's almost full for next year now, but you can certainly get on the waiting list, and he's creating some fantastic day ticket lakes down there as well. So clearwaterfisheries.co.uk. Be seeing you, Mark.
Yes, stay safe.
Check out the website at www.thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue.